this week. The Dow Jones Industrials Average finished the year at a new all-time record weekly close, its highest point in its 117-year history. And the precious metals added a few points, wrapping up a challenging year in the plus column. Welcome, everyone. Chris Walczyk here, back with you. We've got a big encore show this week, nearly 3 hours of our best interviews, including Dr. Ron Paul and several other must-hear guest interviews. And Robert Ian wraps up the show. We'll be back with you next week with an all-new episode in the first show of 2015. Until then, happy holidays and happy new year. Just last week, a guest on this show suggested that we need to resurrect President Andrew Jackson, the great bank fighter who announced 160 years ago that government will no longer use the Second Bank of the United States, i.e. a beta version of our current Fed. We both agreed that my next guest embodies much of his spirit. For decades, Dr. Ron Paul fought the powers that be who shackle our monetary system, and he's a voice for restoring our innate personal freedoms. Welcome, Dr. Paul.
Thank you very much. Nice to be with you.
Well, it's an honor to have you back, sir. And, you know, it's interesting, this trend around the globe, gold repatriation. You penned an interesting article on this. Hugo Chavez, you might recall, the late Venezuelan president. Mexico followed suit, Germany. Your state of Texas requested the return of its gold. And now you say Switzerland, the Swiss people, need to demand the return of their gold. Tell us more, please.
Well, they're having a referendum at the end of this month, and it's interesting, of course, the government, the international, United States, they don't like to see this happening, but the referendum is going to let the people in Switzerland vote on the repatriation of their gold and bring all the gold that is held outside the country back into the country, have a 20% backing of the currency, and obviously quit selling the gold. It was always sad for me to see the shift in the Swiss, because I've always admired their government and their money, their monetary system. But, you know, a few years back, they started joining the international organizations, the IMF, and participating in getting rid of the gold. And so hopefully this is, they were the last to just throw in the towel and go along with the internationalists. Let's hope they're the first ones to step up and start leading the charge away from this. So it'll be interesting to see how this referendum turns out.
Another country, though, that never leased out any gold, China, they're accumulating roughly the world's output each year. And, of course, they're now not only the largest consumer, as you know, but they're also the world's largest producer of gold. They just can't seem to get enough. Do you suspect that they're planning to unpeg the yuan from the dollar?
I believe that is the case, that they're making those plans. If they don't follow through with the precise plans of reestablishing the next currency, they will at least be stuck with all that gold, you know, and they'll have such a difficult time with that, because that's going to be they'll be a lot better off than just holding fiat money. Now, the Chinese are very definitely preparing themselves for the next monetary reform. And it won't be exactly like it was, but it could be very similar to what it was like for the United States being in the driver's seat after World War II. You know, we were spared the carnage and the damage of World War II. Many people had already parked their gold in the United States, and they owed us a lot of money, so we had a lot of gold. And so we were in the driver's seat for the IMF, and that's how we were able to establish the dollar, you know, as the currency of the world, and have the ability to create the reserve currency. Now, the sun's real good, and it was, and we benefited, and we still benefit from this, but time finally is running out on us. We were in the driver's seat, but less so every single day. And with our deficits that we have here, our weakening economy, and with the endless wars that we start, I think the people ultimately who write the rules on gold are the ones that hold it and any type of monetary reform. And I think it's interesting that over the years of my asking Federal Reserve Board chairman, you know, why do you hold the gold? And they really don't have a good reason. Well, we know why they hold the gold. And of course, the most recent time I asked that was with Bernanke. He said, well, I guess it's just tradition.
Because it's real money. It's sound money. And it's prescribed by our Constitution. You really were also on the forefront of folks trying to audit the Fed's reserves. For the longest time, people just didn't have any interest, but it's gaining momentum now. If there is gold at the bottom of Fort Knox, and as well as the New York Fed, and then there's West Point, those three key places, and it's close to what they have on their books, that's fine. But has it been leased out? Do we really have ownership to it?
That is a big question. So even if I had had the chance and walked through and they say, well, there it is. If you want them, count them, count them. Just look at the stacks of gold. It doesn't mean anything whatsoever. It's the shenanigans that they deal with, because it's just who owns the gold that really counts. So it's very, very healthy that the countries are starting to ask for their gold back. But it's very disappointing and eye-opening that the fact that we never give it back to them. And then they don't seem to complain. I'm just amazed that the Germans didn't get a little bit annoyed when they say, well, maybe in 7 years we'll get around to giving you some of your gold back. So, no, that is the question. Who has the gold? Has it been sold? Does somebody else own it? Has it been leased out? And just what is going on? But I don't think that's the way the Chinese are dealing with it. I think they're taking delivery. I think they own it and they hold it.
You know, I think it's well said. And if I could just speculate, as you mentioned, Germany and their surprisingly sanguine view of our decision to send them a pittance of what they have here, when, as you know, what was in the Paris vaults was returned almost immediately. But one thing that comes to mind is the Ukraine drama. I find it ironic that there was some interesting gold shenanigans that was going on there precisely around the time when Germany was demanding its gold back. Then suddenly they have a military threat in that region. Maybe they cooled their jets a little bit about getting their gold back.
Yeah, that's surely a possibility. But I think most people have bought into the official explanation. Well, the problems in Ukraine, it's the Russians. You know, they're getting ready to reestablish the Soviet system and invade all of Europe and take it over, which is complete nonsense. But the argument that I think you're leading into, that the crisis was an economic crisis dealing with money and debt, just as all the major crises ever since our crisis hit in 7 and 8, it's debt. It's too much debt and how it's taken care of. And we sort of escaped the total failure of the system because they still were willing to take our dollars, and we printed money endlessly and bailed out so many people. But that won't continue forever. But I think that's exactly what was happening in Ukraine. And they were looking for the highest bidder. You know, were the Europeans going to help them out and bail them out? And or would it be the Russians? And that's how the division came. And all of a sudden, the Westerners, including us in Europe, had to overthrow the elected leader, Yanukovych. And, of course, the crisis continues. But I think most of these crises that we're going to see and are seeing are economically driven. And it has to do with living beyond our means and governments having no answer for the problems they have.
Well, I just throw into the ring there. Talk about economically driven. We look at the energy interest. Let's call them Western energy interests. But, you know, folks on this show have pointed out it's not just Western energy interests. It's global interest now in that region. That also, I think, adds to your point that this was economic and far less political. I think we've covered the precious metals and markets pretty closely. As we wrap up that portion and get onto some of your more recent articles, I wanted to ask you if maybe this bear market is getting a bit long. We've had quite a sell-off. Goldman Sachs and a few others are calling for maybe $900 to $1,000 as a floor for the yellow metal. Do you have any just gut instincts? We're not asking you to time the market. We'd like to know what you think.
The one thing I've learned in studying Austrian economics, which I follow closely, is that we ought to have the ability to identify bubbles and distortions and malinvestment, excessive debt, and that you can anticipate problems coming from that. But the school also teaches timing is something else. There's a lot of subjectivity to it. You don't know what world events will be. And at times you think, well, this is unsustainable. Well, lo and behold, The blind trust that they place in their caretakers at the Fed and in the government, you know, there's more faith than they deserve, and they hold it together. So I don't do much on timing, but, you know, over the years, especially since I've been involved in the presidential races, a lot of young people got fascinated with the Fed, and they got fascinated with gold and silver and real money and this sort of thing. And, of course, some of them, early on, invested in it and tried to protect themselves, but others think, got too high, I'm not going to do it. But anybody, I think, that has any interest in it and just wonders about it, and since I don't preach timing, I still believe that right now, systematically, people are starting to buy silver and gold. They don't have to, put their whole life savings into it, but on a steady basis and price average it. So I would think, and if it goes down more, I think it's really an opportunity for some people and plan, unless you have doubt about what governments do. If you think the government's going to do much better on the job, but if you think government's going to continue to spend and print money, then preparing oneself with a little bit of insurance against that, I think, is a good idea. And they can do that without knowing exactly the day, market will turn around and you see gold going up $100 a day. So I don't think I can help anybody out on that issue.
I think it's well said. The currency wars are fully underway here. We heard from the BOJ just last Friday that they are going to try to follow in Dr. Bernanke's footsteps.
Some people argue, it saved the country and it saved the world, so why shouldn't everybody do it? And then people say, the dollar looks pretty good. It's gone up here in the last 6 months, so it's a wonderful thing. So these people who want sound money, they're off on a tangent. But how can you compare the value of a dollar to the value of a euro or some other currency? It's what do you compare it to? But if it's truly measured in an accurate way to the cost of living in the lower 50% of our population, believe me, the income never keeps up and prices always go up higher for that group of people, and their standard of living goes down, and they always pay a price. And that means that the dollar crisis that's going on, no matter what the statistics show or how the government and the Federal Reserve keeps preaching, the grand recovery from the Great Recession, I think the large number of people, and it might even be more than 50% of the people now, it might be closer to 70% of the people who are really hurting from this financial ongoing crisis, which is a monetary crisis.
The middle class, the statistics show, the Fed's own statistics, are hit hardest in this crisis. The heart of this country is what the powers that be are after here. I wanted to ask you about Ebola. Sure seems to have some of the hallmarks of a frightening pandemic. And you say we can't trust our officials. We need to let the market do its job. Can you give us a quick synopsis?
The whole thing is from the beginning, I didn't like the idea that they knew absolutely how bad it was going to be, and therefore it was a reason to call out the governments, and send in the army and solve these problems. I thought it was way overextended, and right now I think a lot of people are backing away from all the scare tactics. But why should we resort to government? What problems do they ever solve? They create problems. So I don't see, sending 3,000 soldiers over into that region making much sense. And once again, there's economics involved. The few that ended up with Ebola here in this country, since we have a better medical system, they have not had a difficult time. But in a poverty-ridden country where they don't have markets and no wealth, and they run into all these kind of problems. And then there's a lot of politicizing and demagoguing that goes on. So I don't like any time I see the government trying to scare the people and trying to justify even more government and more spending, I become suspicious.
Dr. Paul, we want to thank you for being an inspiration to all of our listeners and wish you continued success, sir.
Thank you. Nice to be with you today. We'll be right back.
Professor Kotlikoff, a professor of economics at Boston University and author of Clash of the Generations, as well as author of the INFORM Act, the Intergenerational Financial Obligations Reform Act, focused on improving the welfare of every American. Welcome back, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin today with your well-known U.S. national debt calculation that our fiscal gap is about 15 or more times the reported $12 trillion official national debt. Maybe tell us some of the implications of such an enormous debt on our national balance sheet.
So we've been running a Ponzi scheme for decades at the government level. Both parties have participated in it. What we do is we take money from young people. We call it taxes. We hand it to old people. And then at the same time, we promise young people that they'll get back money in the future in exchange for these taxes. But what they'll get back won't be called principal plus interest. It will be called transfer payments. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. These are examples. So had we used different words, we would have a vastly larger official debt. So what we've done is we've kept liabilities off the books. We've put them off the books or kept them off the books just the same way Enron did in their accounting before they went under and were discovered. But the U.S. government has done this in a massive manner. And it's not just, let me be clear, the liabilities are not just Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, but there's government defense spending. We have to cover defense spending from now really through the end of time. It's not like the defense, our defense needs are going to go away entirely ever. We have to pay for the president's lunch every day. There's a whole host of liabilities that the government has, and they also have a host of revenues coming in. And if you look in present value, the value in the present of all the expenditure commitments and all the taxes that are projected to pay for those commitments, and you use the congressional budget's projections here, not mine, you find that the fiscal gap is $210 trillion large to be compared with the $13 trillion in official debt that the government's reporting. So we've been looking at the trees, not the forest. We've been looking at the bushes, really, when it comes to understanding our fiscal finances. And I'm speaking not as a right-wing Republican. You know, somebody says that the country's running a Ponzi scheme might sound like somebody from the Tea Party, right? I'm actually somebody who's voted Democratic presidents for years, including President Obama twice. So it's not coming out of any partisan position. I'm not a local person. I think that both parties are just awful when it comes to dealing with our fiscal issues, and both parties are complicit in leaving enormous burdens for our kids and grandkids, and it's all going to end very badly. So this is strong language and statements, but it doesn't mean it's not true. We have in the INFORM Act, if you go to the informact.org, this fiscal gap accounting has been formally endorsed by over 1,200 economists from every top university in the country: Princeton, Yale, Harvard, MIT, Stanford, Chicago, Brown, you name it, every top place, every Ivy League school is represented. And there was also 17 Nobel Prize winners who have endorsed this bill. Now, you can't get 17 economists degree on anything, let alone 1,200, and let alone get 17 Nobel laureates to say this is what we should do. So this is the economics profession in mass saying that we're cooking the books, and that we need to do honest, long-term, intertemporal budgeting. And the fiscal gap is our best tool, and it shows the country's bankrupt.
It appears as though you're up against quite an enormous edifice. For instance, when we talk to the entrenched interests, this neo-Keynesian outlook, which I think, you know, John Maynard Keynes wouldn't even recognize 80 years ago, it does seem to be at the heart of what you're battling against.
Well, I would say it's not just Keynesian. We have, I view Keynesian economics as kind of black magic, and I view supply side economics as equally black magic. So we've got people on both sides of the political aisle trying to win elections by hiding our fiscal realities, keeping that from the taxpayers, and then promising that you can cut taxes, don't have to pay for what you spend, or that you can spend more and it will pay for itself. The economy will expand. So from Art Laffer on the one hand to Paul Krugman on the other, when it comes to any kind of responsible statement about what kind of policies will actually pay for themselves. You know, so Krugman is saying, let's just spend more. It's going to stimulate the economy, and we're going to get so much more revenue as a result that it will pay for itself. And Art Laffer is saying, cut tax rates. People will work so much more. It'll stimulate the economy, and bingo, you'll have the only tax rate that I see that has the potential to really stimulate the economy if you cut it. And certainly if you could replace that tax source with higher personal income taxes, would be the corporate income tax. If we eliminated the corporate income tax and had shareholders having to pay taxes every year on the profits that their corporations earn for them, impute the share of profits to them and have them paid on a personal level, then you would actually stimulate the economy quite a lot. And I've simulated that with some other economists. If people go to Kotlikoff.net, they can see an article called Simulating the Elimination of the Corporate Income Tax, and they can read about this. So, but in general, just cutting personal rates is not going to expand the economy, and it's really going to do the opposite. It's going to give people an incentive to consume more. The country will save even less than it is. It's already saving at 2%. Used to save at 15% of national income. It's investing next to nothing as well. Used to invest 15% of national income. Now our net investment is 2% of national, 4% of national income. So what we've seen in the post-war period is that a really negative impact on these measures of economic performance, saving, and investment. And that's really what economic simulation models would predict. If you run these policies, you encourage consumption, you discourage saving and investment, and the people that are consuming so much more relative, you know, compared to anybody else, are the elderly. Their consumption, their average consumption, take a 75-year-old. The average consumption of a 75-year-old used to be about 40% below that of a 40-year-old. Now it's probably twice, 100% larger than that of a 40-year-old.
Professor, you've raised so many interesting issues here. It reminds one of the receding waterline at a public beach. There's nothing on the horizon, but suddenly the water recedes drastically. Boats are, you know, left high and dry, and then the tsunami suddenly appears on the horizon 100 feet high. When will the crest of this tide reach our shores? You see it coming, and many of your colleagues, as you say, it's virtually impossible to get so many academics and intellectuals on board of any topic, but they're pounding the table here. What will be the signs of the approaching tidal wave?
Well, if enough people start taking notice, people need to understand that the government's printing a lot of money to pay Congress's bills. I mean, the Federal Reserve has been. Unfortunately, Chairman Yellen has stopped that practice, but Ben Bernanke printed money like he increased the basic money supply by a factor of 4. So when people see these kinds of fiscal problems, they're going to realize that the government's going to be printing money, even more money in the future than it's already printed. It's already laid the foundation for hyperinflation, given what it's printed in the last 7 years. And they're going to not accept a long-term interest rate on treasury, 30-year treasury bills or whatever it is, 3-4% right now. They're going to demand 20%, some high number to deal with their expectations of inflation. So what would happen is that interest rates will shoot up, and that will depress the economy, potentially put us in a recession. So we're just, we have a gradual increase in interest rates. It doesn't have to necessarily have a crisis overnight, but the more likely scenario is a kind of a gradual malaise, which is kind of what's gripped the country for decades now. We've got a lot of people that aren't earning much money. They're not earning much more than they earned back in the mid-60s in terms of average take-home pay in today's dollars. So the economy's got a lot of problems. I'm not saying the fiscal policy has caused all these problems. Make the investments in the country that we need, whether it's education or infrastructure. So this is going kind of the path of Argentina, which used to be the fifth highest per capita GDP country in the world, and now it's a developing country again. This happens to countries that run policies like we're running. I can't emphasize enough the importance of getting the Inform Act passed, and all your listeners, they all have senators and congressmen. They all need to get on the horn and get that bill passed. And all they have to do is go to theinformact.org, learn about the bill, and then really get very active in supporting that bill.
Professor, when you talk to many of the folks in economics today, it's just so counterintuitive to the entrenched interest, I think you'd agree, is heresy, to the mindset, I think, that started around, I think you'd probably agree, around the Reagan era. But you've found the flaw. You've identified the fatal Achilles heel. How can we make this more palatable to people who really require a sea change in their thinking?
Well, they can read our book, The Clash of Generations, that I wrote with Scott Burns. We explain pretty clearly why the fiscal gap is the only relevant measure for our fiscal situation, why it's so big. Part of it is the demographics. The country is getting relatively old, but in large part, we're just spending far more than we're taking in taxes. We've been doing so for many years now, and we are continuing, the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, is projecting that into the future, even under their most realistic scenario, which is called the alternative fiscal scenario. So we have to change course. And whether you're Democrat, Republican, or independent, if you have kids, you have to say, look, the most important thing is making sure we have a healthy economy for our kids. We can't leave them massive fiscal burdens that they won't be able to pay. We're going to get caught up in all this because we won't get our Social Security checks or our Medicare checks. People think that Social Security is in somewhat bad shape, but it's manageable. We can raise the taxes in Social Security a little bit and somehow we'll be okay for a while. That's not true. Social Security has its own fiscal gap calculation, which they actually do, the trustees do, but they hide the actuaries of the Social Security Administration do the calculation, but they hide it in a appendix to the trustees report, which is in table, I think it's 6F1 at this point, very way in the back of the trustees report. It shows the system is 33% underfinanced, and that means that we need a 4 cents on the dollar tax hike. Every dollar of covered earnings, you pay taxes now. Social Security taxes, 12.4% employer plus employee on all your earnings up to about $117,000 right now. If we have to have a 4 percentage point increase, that means 4 cents out of every dollar up to $117,000 would have to go to the government and you get nothing back. That's if we do it immediately. If we don't, the tax hike has to be even bigger. Now, this is not me doing anything but looking at the trustees' own table and just trustees' report table and telling the trustees something that they apparently don't have the political courage to pronounce, which is that Social Security is broke. It's in far worse shape than the Detroit pension funds. But Social Security itself is not as in bad a shape as the overall fiscal enterprise, which is about 58% underfinanced. In other words, we need an immediate and permanent 58% increase in every single tax, federal tax, FICA taxes, corporate income taxes, personal income taxes, estate and gift taxes, excise taxes, to come up in present value with $210 trillion to close this fiscal gap if we're just doing it through tax changes. So if people go to my website, which is kotlikoff.net, they can follow some of my columns about this problem. I've got a website called thepurpleplans.org. They can go there. And then for personal protection, in terms of their own finances, I have a small company on the side that does personal personal financial planning, and we have a website called MaximizeMySocialSecurity.com, which helps people figure out what to get, how to get the most from Social Security. Now, that may sound contradictory. Why am I decrying the financial status of Social Security and at the same time trying to help people get what's theirs? Well, the reason is that I think everybody needs to get everything, you know, we need to treat people fairly if we've got a system. So some people should not make out like bandits because they understand the ins and outs of the Social Security system, which is incredibly complicated, and others not. So we put together this top-ranked software called Maximize My Social Security, which helps people. We also have another program that does long-term financial planning at esplanner.com. It stands for Economic Security Planner, esplanner.com. So, you know, I do, I'm trying to help people at the personal level, but also help our kids, and we have to make changes. And the purpleplans.org have a set of plans that fix things.
Before we ramp up, I wonder, is there any simple way that we can express just how broke, unfortunately, the country is today? You know, most of the talk seems to be pointing to 10, 30, 40 years in the future.
$210 trillion, and it's a credit card bill, and it's today's credit card bill, and it's growing with interest. It grew $5 trillion between last year and this year. So it was $205 trillion last year, now it's $210 trillion this year. So we're not broke in 10 years or 30 years or 50 years. We're broke today as a nation, just like Detroit is broke today. Yeah, could they get by for another year or two? Well, at some point people realized, creditors realized that the city is broke and they weren't going to lend any more money to Detroit because they looked ahead. And we're not looking ahead, but when you do look ahead, you see this country is in far, far worse shape than Detroit.
Are Detroit and Memphis canaries in the coal mine? Are they the ant farm that we need to be watching?
No, we just need to pass the fiscal, the Inform Act. Then the Congressional Budget Office will be forced to make public what the entire economics profession is saying needs to be done. And then we'll start discussing publicly and nationally the fiscal gap. And then the whole conversation won't be about $13 trillion debt, but a $210 trillion fiscal gap.
Okay, Dr. Kotlikoff, we want to thank you for an excellent discussion today. And we will put up links to direct our listeners over to the Inform Act as well as all of your latest topicality. Best of luck to you, sir.
It's been a great pleasure. Bye-bye.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
It's a pleasure to welcome back David McIlvaney, President and CEO of the McIlvaney Financial Company and Director of the Swiss Corporation Global Gold. Welcome back to the show, Mr. McIlvaney.
Good to be with you.
As we were discussing before the broadcast today, we were talking about the Fed governors. They cut their monthly bond buying stimulus, as expected, another $10 billion, and that's down to about $15 billion per month from a peak of $85 billion, I guess, last year. They're still holding rates near zero, and, of course, this will have profound, you know, implications on the markets in the months to come and maybe even for years to come. So I know listeners would really like to find out your comments and your thoughts on just what these FOMC moves could mean for their portfolio's bottom line, please.
Well, we assume that the Fed can do what they say they can do, and that's, I think, the problem. You've got two things going on. Number one, as you mentioned, the mortgage-backed securities and the Treasury purchases, those being tapered to zero at the end of October, there is going to be a different reality. Can those markets take care of themselves without outside stimulus? And that has yet to be proven. So my suspicion is that just like QE1 and QE2, there was a boost in the marketplaces in the context of QE1 and QE2, and as they dwindled, so did the asset prices that were commensurate there. And so I think we will see a drop in the stock market. I think we will see some pressure in the real estate market and equities both. The other issue is rates and the balance sheet. And raising rates and decreasing the balance sheet, those are pipe dreams. Those are pipe dreams. So again, they talk about one thing. Do they actually have the power to do it? $17.76 trillion in debt. Interest payments on that will rise with an increase in interest rates. While the Fed may talk about doing that, when you talk with Congress, the question is going to be, fiscally, can we afford an increase of 1%, 1.5%, 2%? What's the threshold before bankruptcy? And yeah, I don't think the threshold's very high, frankly, because $17.76 trillion is a lot of money. 6% debt growth this year with not as strong GDP growth to match it.
I feel that it's a topic that's flown under the radar screen. You'll recall that the tops that come to mind, Moody's, Fitch, and S&P. Now, I find it fascinating that of the three, at least to my knowledge now, S&P is the only agency to significantly lower the rating on U.S. debt. And I suspect that's going to change in the years to come for precisely the reasons that you've laid out here, because folks have to start planning. What should investors be doing? What steps and contingencies can they be making now?
You know, frankly, I think owning gold is your contingency plan. It's insurance, as far as I'm concerned, in the idea that, again, just going back to the FOMC's own words, you know, they've basically said the Fed funds rate is going to be at 1.375 by the end of 2015 and 3.75 at the end of 2017, and they're going to use reverse repos as a part of their exit strategy. Say, can we afford the Fed funds rate at 3.75 with close to $18 trillion in debt, and we'll probably add at least another $500 billion next year? And the answer is a resounding no. So you can say whatever you want about the strategy that lies ahead. It's preposterous. And then to suggest that reverse repos are a part of an exit strategy, I'm just wondering if Janet Yellen even understands what a reverse repurchase agreement is. Because essentially what you do is you give an asset to a financial institution with the guarantee of buying back that asset at some point in the future. So you may have reduced your balance sheet with X exposure, but all you've done is substitute it with cash. That's the first issue. And the second issue is, just like a boomerang, that asset's coming right back to you, because the nature of a reverse repo is that you're going to buy it back. And so I'm just wondering about our leadership at the Fed, and I'm wondering if it's not any different than the types of decisions which were made by Greenspan and by Bernanke, supposedly solving problems when in fact what they were doing was laying the groundwork for the next major crisis. And I'm afraid that's what we have in front of us. So if you think there's the possibility that between government bureaucrats, Fed officials, and our leading economists that something happens in the next 6 to 12 months, then I again go back to, don't you want some insurance? Which boils down to one thing. You want ounces? You want more ounces? You want as many ounces as possible.
They've juiced the system. They have not addressed the problems that got us into the last crisis. I think you'd probably agree, back in 2007, 2008. In fact, they've just kind of painted over it. And unfortunately, the corrosion is now bursting through. And at some point, you know, the back of the vehicle might just crumble altogether. I mean, we are facing an even more frightening overall, at least, scenario in the economy. And for instance, as you pointed to, the housing market, you know, all they've done is really blown bubble 2.0. We have a mountain of debt that has not been addressed. And really, our top banks, financial institutions, are still carrying well in excess of $300 trillion of interest rate sensitive derivatives. So to me, it's an accident just, you know, looking for a piece of property to happen. What kind of timing are you putting on this? And that's a tricky question. You know, a lot of guests will shy away from it. I have a feeling that you have some parameters, a domain that you could put around this disaster that you see.
Well, sure. sure. And I would suggest that for all the problems we've just described, one of the possible solutions is for us to grow our way out of it. We're not seeing real indications of that right now. In fact, the Rockefeller Institute just came out with a report showing for the most recent quarter, April to June of this year, personal income tax collections are declining sharply in nominal terms by 7%. And this is the first time since the fourth quarter of 2009 that state personal income tax revenue has declined for two consecutive quarters. We can grow our way out of it, but you're going to see an indication of that growth by, you know, an improvement in sort of people's bottom line. What are you bringing in an income? And if your income's not increasing, then I think you can assume that any growth we're seeing in the economy is not from sort of the nuts and bolts, healthy, sustainable, organic style of growth, but from added leverage, added debt to the system. And that is, in fact, what we're seeing happen. So, you know, I want to say, yes, there's great hope out there. On the other hand, we're going to have to see a lot more delivered for that hope to be realized. Time frame, I think 2015 to 2017 are going to represent something of a financial meat grinder. And in 2015 to 2017, I think investors need to ask themselves the question, to what degree do I intend to be grist in the mill? We've got the bond market, which is at an extreme level, both here and overseas, where people have been searching for yield and buying everything that wasn't nailed down in order to lock in their income needs, irrespective of the risk they were taking in terms of credit quality. You've got the stock market, which has more levered money in it than at any other time in world history. Okay, so if you're looking at margin debt as a percentage of GDP in nominal terms, of course it's much higher than it was in 1929. It's even higher than it was in 2000-2007. At those peaks in the market, you've got more levered money in terms of margin debt today than you did then. But in all fairness, the economy's larger, the stock market's larger, and everything else. So as a percentage of GDP, it's north of 3%, which is the highest level in history. Where does this end? When does it end? To me, the margin numbers mean everything because the clock is already ticking. If we had $100 billion in margin debt, that'd be one thing. We've got over $460 billion in margin debt, which is clearly enough to get the enough of a snowball, if you will, to create a snowball effect and create a real avalanche of selling, of mass liquidations in the marketplace. Add to that the fact that you've got 60-80% of current volumes on the New York Stock Exchange coming from high-frequency trading, which frankly could care less if they're long or short, and I think all of a sudden the avalanche becomes something of sort of historical proportion. So when does that come unglued? It's borrowed money. It has to be paid back. Whoever's in those equity positions is paying 6-8% for the privilege of using borrowed money to speculate in the stock market. It literally, the clock is ticking. Anytime between now and the end of 2017, I think you've got a doozy, worse than 1929 potentially.
We have virtually marginal participation in this equities rally. And that's something that I think that should be the wake-up call for most investors out there, that really John Q. Public, the middle class, they don't have much skin in this game. And as a result, when the margin gets scared, when the hot money says, you know what, it looks like the downside is the play here. Contingency plans must be put in place here. And as you said earlier, one of the best, if not the best, is the precious metals market. And if nothing else, maybe diversifying or increasing exposure in one's portfolio substantially to gold and silver and related equities is at least one method for protecting what they've built up. So what I'd like to address now, if you don't mind, is the precious metals equities. My guess is you have some interesting thoughts there. There's, I guess, two ways to really look at what's happened in the last few years. It's been a very trying period for most people involved, but you might also say, well, there's opportunity here. I mean, we're seeing discounted prices. What's your take on the precious metals equities, please?
A purchase of precious metals equity should come with a bottle of Pepto-Bismol. I mean, I think that goes without saying. So think pink when you're thinking gold or silver in that regard. What we see in the precious metals equities are levels relative to gold comparable to 2000, 2001. And so from a relative standpoint, they're very inexpensive. If gold lingers here at these levels for 2-3 years, you probably lose a quarter to a third of the field through bankruptcy. I'm not sure that it's going to linger that long because, again, when you look at the equities market is kind of your litmus test for how the general public thinks, you know, things are going. And on the one hand, you can look at Gallup polls, which show 70% of people unhappy with the current state of the economy. And on the other hand, if you ask them how things are going and if they can point to anything solid that's favorable, they'll say, well, but the stock market's doing okay. And on that basis, you see stocks high, gold low. There's really no reason to own it in this environment. But I would contest that and say the day stock market rolls over, you're going to see people looking for safe havens. Treasuries may be a part of that. Dollars and cash may be a part of that. And I think gold and silver certainly will be as well. I have a hard time seeing that time clock go to sort of the critical 2-3 year period, which would cause, you know, a major winnowing of the field in the gold shares. Finding producers that have a low cost per ounce, you know, you want people who can stay in case we're wrong on the timing. So that I think is worth considering. I own them. I've added to positions in the last 2 weeks. If we see prices diminish further, I mean, as a company, we added to positions in December, in January, and we're handsomely rewarded with some moves higher. And for shares that we owned at higher prices, of course, a recovery in value as we saw an increase from January to the mid-year. I think that's a little bit of a taste of what is to come. We may not be completely out of the woods yet, but I think for someone who takes a long view, not a trader's perspective, in it for a day, a week, a month, or even a year, but for someone who takes a long view and says, yeah, I think I like the direction of gold over the next 2-5 years, what you have with the miners is essentially a non-expiring call option on the price of gold. The problem with options is that time is against you, and you never know when the market's going to do what it's supposed to do. And if your timing's off, you lose everything. To own a miner is to own a non-expiring call option on the price of gold, and that's somewhat intriguing to me.
Well, you know, prediction, very tricky business, particularly when it regards the future, as it's been said. But I still would like to hear your thoughts regarding whether or not this could be the final move forward for equities. I'm not talking this week, this month, maybe even this year, but this primary push that we've seen, let's say from around 2009 until now, this 5-year equities rally, by some metrics, of course, one of the best rallies even since the 1920s, you could argue. The Dow is at an all-time, at least nominal, record high. The S&P 500 closing weekly record highs, maybe not today or this week, but in recent memory. So this is a unique time, and I don't think we've seen anything like this since the year 2000. Could this be a whole new, I don't know, inflationary paradigm shift, or could we be approaching a peak that our progeny will look back upon as the new 1929 market top?
Listen, I think the FOMC, they did not look at the Stock Traders Almanac for when they were winding down their quantitative easing 3 program. September and October historically are where you have significant crashes. You can look at a variety of periods and go back a long, long ways and see that. You had September 24th, 1869. You had the 1907 period, mid-October, after the Hepburn Act was put in place. You had 1929. You had, you know, the fall of 1987. You also have 2000 and 2007. I mean, over and over again, there's seasonal weakness. And the fact that they're pulling liquidity from the market in a period of seasonal weakness, I think, increases the probability that we are putting in a monumental peak here. Now, maybe they come out in 2015 with a new razzle-dazzle $5 trillion expansion of the balance sheet, double it from here. They can do that, and who knows what kind of rabbits they can pull out of the hat. We know that they can create trillions of dollars out of nothing. Maybe they can create rabbits ex nihilo as well. I think this is a terrible time to be pulling in their horns. Not that I like what they were doing in the first place. I mean, frankly, I love Schumpeter's idea of creative destruction. I would have loved to see the 2008-2009 be a period where, you know, banks that didn't have any business being in business would be gone. So one of your questions about valuations and your comment, too, that 2000 was really the number to shoot for, because 2000 was the highest we've ever seen the stock market in terms of fundamental valuation metrics, far beyond 1929, far beyond 1987, even far beyond 2007. But 2014 is running neck and neck with those levels of highest valuation, the only period in U.S. financial history where the stock market has had higher valuations. If you're looking at price earnings or cyclically adjusted price earnings, yes, you've got to go to the year 2000. Now, maybe we're not to those levels, but we're marching ever closer. How close do you have to get to something that is objectively noted before you say again, here we are again?
These levels, these valuations are being cajoled by more than just hot money here in the United States. I mean, we, at least for quite some time, there was some flight away from Europe, not only due to the fact that they have a comparatively sluggish economy, but we also had the Ukraine-Russia drama, did we not? And that, of course, caused a lot of investors to scratch their heads, look around, where can we go? Well, we don't want to miss the party in the U.S. equities market. What do you think?
Yeah, it's fascinating to me that this era of investors is somewhat blind to various risks that need to be accommodated in a portfolio. You have inflation risk, you have deflation risk, you have volatility, you have liquidity risk, you have geopolitical risk, you have even domestic political risk, where policies can change and adversely impact a company or their program for growth. You've got uncertainty related to regulations and taxes. All of these things need to be present in an investor's mind. It's not sort of put your money down as you would in Vegas and roll the dice. There is actually a thoughtful process that goes into successful value investing. And in this environment, to ignore something as blatant as geopolitical risk, whether it's conflict in the Middle East, I mean, we're dropping bombs in the last couple of days and no one really seems to care. Basically, put Russia in a very interesting and awkward position by bringing NATO forces to their doorstep. I mean, if you roll the clock back, if you look as a student of history and say, you know, what kept the French out of Russia? What kept the Germans out of Russia? It was this 1,000-mile barrier, land barrier, that we just shrunk by putting a U.S.-oriented leadership in the Ukraine. Is it reasonable for them? Let's not even say reasonable. Can we understand why they would be agitated? Yes, we can understand why they would be agitated. All I'm saying is that the markets have not taken any of this into consideration, and it's as if central bank activity is the silver bullet and the cure-all for everything. As long as the ECB, the Bank of Japan, the Bank of England, and the Fed are willing to print like mad, there is nothing that can happen in the world which will disturb us, because we know the central bankers have our backs. And I'm telling you, this is very much like the prisoner's dilemma. The prisoner's dilemma is like when the players in a game, everyone knows they have to stay in for it to continue to work. But everyone also knows that they may want to be the person who gets out. Does this make sense? The system works as long as no one breaks from the system, but to avoid being in the system as it's breaking down, you have to be the first one to break out. What we're doing is the world of traders and professional money managers are all assuming that they are the guy who's going to get out. But everyone's still in, and everyone's still in because the central bank continues to promise the sun, moon, and stars, and when the Fed stops to promise the sun, moon, and stars, the ECB takes the baton and takes it a little bit further. This, to me, is one of the most perilous times of investing in certainly my lifetime, and our family's been doing this for several generations. I'd have to say risk is undervalued, underappreciated, and underinsured in a major, major way.
You started off the point with what I think is the most important key concept that I hope listeners take away from this discussion. This lack of understanding, even misconception, with regard to the components that we must have in a portfolio. And what's happened is we're victims of our own success. At least I think that's one aspect to this story. And what I mean by success is that, well, we've had this amazing contrived period period that's been fomented by the FOMC, the ECB, and others around the world. And that has helped us to recover, of course, from the Great Recession. I mean, I don't even hear the term thrown around much anymore. Just a few years ago, we were all talking about it. Well, it seems to have been relegated to the past so quickly because of the liquidity and the rest of the measures that have been taken. Back on point, though, your family have been in this industry for so long, and so you would be well-versed in the understanding that a solid portfolio must be made up of much more than just the traditional stocks and bonds. I mean, you need international exposure, you need commodities, precious metals, so many components. Why don't I let you have the floor here to give people just maybe a basic overview of what they need to be considering now, other than just 5 or 10% precious metals weighting. Maybe that weighting should be higher.
And if we go too fast, our website has something that I think is particularly helpful. We call it our perspective triangle, and we go into an in-depth discussion of what that is. I'll give the brief version here, and for anyone interested, McIlvaney.com is a helpful resource on that particular issue. Look for the perspective triangle in the resources section. You're asking your assets to do certain things for you, and I think as you're diversifying a portfolio, you need to be very clear on what the mandates are that you're giving your assets. I talk about gold and silver as an insurance policy because that's the role they play in a portfolio. That, to us, is the basis. It's like the foundation of a portfolio. Now, beyond an insurance measure, which may replace lost purchasing power or compensate for market volatility in other assets that you own with an increase in value given the stress and strain in the stock market, bond market, real estate markets, what have you, that insurance component is very critical. You move to another category, what we would describe, again, by its mandate, liquidity. This could be cash. This could be cash equivalents. Why do you have it? Well, if there's an immediate opportunity that you can only take advantage of by writing a check, yes, you need instant liquidity. But what about managing a household or managing a business? Yes, you have to have adequate liquidity. If you don't have adequate liquidity, you can find yourself going from liquidity crisis to solvency crisis very quickly. So insurance is one thing you have to adequately address. Precious metals does that. Liquidity is another component that you have to address. Cash or cash equivalents addresses that. The growth elements are where Wall Street tends to hang their hats and say, listen, you've got some money and you want more. Well, that's pretty basic. That's pretty basic, and it appeals to sort of our instinct to greed. And so everyone gets slammed into a growth category by and large. And then as you get older, they moderate that somewhat and say, you also need some income. You know, listen, I think Warren Buffett's genius is not in being a value investor. His genius is in having a predictable and consistent income stream, which allows him to recharge and go play again and recharge and play again. So, you know, yes, you can wait around for growth, particularly when you get to average your cost down, knowing that you've got more income coming in that allows you to add to liquidity and, again, recharge your portfolio at a lower cost basis. So I think if you would look at all of his purchases of equities, you would find that Warren Buffett has actually done pretty well in large part because he lowered his cost basis. He didn't always get it right. He didn't call it the right day, the perfect day, buying on the day that a particular equity traded at its lowest. But by focusing on income in tandem with growth, he was able to accomplish quite a bit. But again, liquidity and insurance next to growth and income, these are the mandates that the perspective triangle tries to, quote-unquote, add perspective to. And I would say in this environment, you could have as much as one-third of your liquid assets in precious metals. Now, one-third, I think, is more than adequate to accomplish, again, risk mitigation in terms of volatility of price in the general equities market, the bond market, the real estate market, and to compensate for loss in purchasing power in your cash equivalent liquidity position. So if you want more than a third, be my guest, but you're going to have that much more volatility, both up and down, and I don't think it's necessary. It's adequate as an insurance policy to max out at about a third.
David McIlvaney, we want to thank you for taking time for us today. Would you like to share any contact information for our listeners to direct their web browsers, the services that you provide, and any other contact information, please?
Well, thank you. McIlvaney.com is the easiest place to find us. That's M-C-A-L-V, as in Victor, A-N-Y, McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. Every Wednesday we do a market commentary, certainly not to compete with yours. Yours is an excellent program. We listen to it. But it's very broad-based, politics, geopolitics, economics, finance. Try to cover quite a bit of ground in that 30 to 45 minutes of audio commentary each Wednesday. And you can subscribe for free at McIlvaney.com. Would encourage you to do that.
All right, David McIlvaney, we're going to look forward to having you back on GoldSeek.com radio.
Thank you, sir.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Well, Charles Goyette penned The Dollar Meltdown, the New York Times bestseller, as well as his latest Red and Blue and broke all over, Restoring America's Free Economy. Welcome back, Charles Goyette.
Chris, great to speak with you again.
Well, let's start off with the first government shutdown in 17 years. You know, the political wrangling appears to hinge primarily on the health care bill, but the administration wants everyone to receive benefits. Meanwhile, Medicare, though, and Medicaid payments will continue. The opposition says no way. Bickering has led to a shutdown in some basic services. Most government agencies are expected to run, though, without closing their doors, at least for a few days to weeks. In your opinion, what are the lasting impacts of this event on the economy?
The lasting impact is very, very bad because, once again, this is a sideshow. Look, the Republicans can lock arms with one another to pretend to fight Obamacare, but they're not serious even about that. They're politically posturing in this regard because, after all, what is the template that the Republicans wish to replace it with? It's Romney care. It's Republican care. It's Boehner care. Nobody in the Republican Party makes a good, coherent argument for a true free market healthcare system that is more widely accessible and more affordable to all people. So they're fighting the state socialist healthcare system with the intent of replacing it with another state socialist healthcare system, but the one that will have their fingerprints on it rather than Obama's fingerprints on it. In the meantime, the real issue that we should be paying attention to is not the shutdown of the government, but it's effectively the long-term shutdown of the currency in our economy.
And I think it's a good segue into just what occurred the last time we saw this debate over the debt ceiling and related issues. You know, we did see the precious metals surge higher. Gold, of course, closed over $1,900 an ounce. And that's not to say that we're going to see a lockstep repeat this time, but folks start to become concerned when they see government shutdown, I think, understandably. Are we going to, you think, see some upward pressure as a result of this as people turn to safe haven investments?
This is the beginning of the fiscal year, the fiscal year 2014. At the end of this year, what will the configuration of federal economics be? The government will be bigger. The debt will be much larger. Spending will have grown. The Fed will have printed more money, created more fiat money out of thin air. You know, with the conjunction of one of my books, in fact, The Dollar Meltdown years ago, I did a chart that got circulated quite widely. It was was very popular. It correlated the increases. In fact, I dealt with this in one of the chapters of the book. Increases in the national debt ceiling with the increase in the price of gold. So it's not fixed. It's not locked in. It doesn't have to be a 1-to-1 move. But over the long trend, we know what happens when they raise the national debt ceiling. That visible government spending will certainly go up under that scenario, but the hidden government spending goes up as well. So the prospect for precious metals is ultimately much, much higher.
No, I think it's a really good point, because it's easy to forget that at the end of the day, I mean, this really is a dollar story. I mean, folks can procure precious metals for many reasons, whether it be speculative or portfolio insurance, all generally good ideas. But ultimately, inflation comes down to the erosion of purchasing power resulting from the national currency and its decline. And as you say, we've seen this trend for many years, but in the last 3 years, the greenback has stabilized somewhat, despite the recent weakness we've had here. Is this simply a pause on the way to lower levels for the greenback, the U.S. dollar?
This is all relative. You know, if things get really, really, really bad in Europe, you know, the dollar seems to rise relative to the European currency or some other currency. But this is all sleight of hand. This is all, you know, you go down to Times Square and you can watch guys playing shell games. This is effectively a shell game. Look, all paper currencies are irredeemable. There's not a redeemable paper currency in the world. There's not a currency that is a claim check on something. You cannot go to the central bank of any nation and turn your paper money in for something real. It's except for more of the same that they can print up in the basement or create electronically. So the value of all paper currencies, of all electronic currencies, is in decline. The purchasing power of all currencies is in long-term decline. So when we hear that the dollar is stable, I don't know, maybe it's, you know, I guess if you have receivables in euros or in yen, these things matter to you. But for most people, it's like saying, you know, that the dollar is descending at a 19% rate, but the other Titanic, the euro, is descending at a 21% rate, so the dollar looks very stable. You know, none of this is true. It is simply not stable, and it will not be stable as long as it can be created willy-nilly by an act of, federal bureaucrats, or as long as the government believes that it can give people something for nothing by deficit spending. So, I mean, all of this is a shell game to say that the dollar is up or the dollar is down against what? Against other paper currencies that are also inherently worthless. So, and the shell game can go on for a long time. I mean, people can be taken in for a long time. The crowd can grow bigger. More and more can be, convinced to lay a $20 down on the table and try to win the shell game and be deceived by it. You know, play three-card Monte on Broadway in New York. I mean, it can go on for a very long time, and indeed it has, but it cannot go on forever.
In this theme of street card hustles, if you will, are we losing our right to such a high AAA credit rating status with, such enormous debt and very little organized effort, I think, to clear the system or leadership in that area, for that matter. If we lose our moniker as the world's reserve currency, how could that impact the economy and the precious metals sector?
Well, it's actually a timely question. It's a very precarious situation, and actually there are people that are suggesting that President Obama, if Congress does not pass to his liking or in his calendar a statutory debt ceiling increase, that he go ahead and authorize the spending of the money anyway, rendering effectively null the role of Congress to create borrowing authority for the government. Look, if they do something like that, they further risk the peril that we're in now of the rest of the world in wide-eyed astonishment looking at us and understanding that this is nothing, you know, this is nothing but a flim-flam. We can issue currency against Federal Reserve operations. We can borrow money relentlessly from the rest of the world, and we do not even have to have statutory authority. What happens when they want to be paid back for their bonds? Hey, what happened to the rule of law? The president pierced the statutory debt ceiling without regard to the rule of law. So this will get the world's attention if they do this. But in any event, the world is slowly waking up to the peril of the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency. I mean, look, China is moving. It's not. It used to be surreptitiously moving, you know, in the direction of gold. There's nothing hidden about it now. And if they end up linking the Chinese yuan to gold in a meaningful way, I mean, not another currency flim-flam, but in some sort of link in which there is some sort of redeemability, then China will have secured its place as the number one commercial nation of the world on the world stage for the next 100 years, and the United States will have slipped and fallen badly.
I mean, we're certainly reading endless articles on this topic, a lot of conjecture regarding whether or not China and Russia are attempting to set up a regional reserve currency that has sound money backing. At least their government operations with regard to procuring the precious metals indicates that they have.
Chris, it's even bigger than at the level of the state, because here in the state, you know, we the American state taxes precious metals at a penalty rate. The American state constantly is at war with gold and silver, trying to keep the American people from availing themselves of its safety. But in China, on the other hand, the people are encouraged to own gold and silver. So it's not just the state enterprise, but it's the people themselves. The people in China, look, these are among the biggest savers in the world. They understand the value of gold and silver. They do not believe, because they don't have a lying state or elected class that tells them, we're going to take care of your retirement, we're going to take care of your health care, we're going to take care of you in your golden age. When you're old, don't worry, everything will be covered. They don't have that. So we've been bamboozled, we've been beguiled, we've been seduced by politicians promising that they will take care of our retirement for us, they will take care of our health care for us, and so Americans have become slipshod as far as saving goes, while the Chinese have been some of the biggest savers in the world, knowing full well that they have to take care of themselves. And when they save, do they want to save irredeemable paper currencies? No, they have a predisposition to gold.
You bring up this concept of government collusion against the precious metals. Imagine, for instance, if the U.S. dollar was taxed at 20-30%. It'd become a worthless relic of a currency. Well, that's precisely what's happened to sound money here in the United States. And I know your comrade and friend of the show here, Ron Paul, has written extensively and talked extensively about this idea of simply removing capital gains tax off gold and silver. It really has no place there whatsoever. It's a penalty for those who wish to protect their savings, but I think it's a systemic penalty to 300 plus million Americans, in that the real currency, the sound money, real money, loses its attractiveness. Any comments?
This policy is witness to the fact that the issuers of the currency even know that they are involved in a flim-flam. Look, when the currency is sound, when the currency is desirable, you don't have to persuade anybody under force of law, under penalty of prison. You don't have to force people with legal tender laws to use it. People desire, people prefer sound currencies, and they will flock to them. They'll demand them in their commercial transactions. They'll use them for their savings. People desire sound, reliable currencies. So when do you need legal tender laws to force people to use currencies? Only when the currency is suspect and people would otherwise use something different. But you've alluded to something actually that Nobel Prize winner Friedrich Hayek championed, and that is, you know, to let currencies compete, and let the if the dollar is desirable in equal circumstances, on equal footing, and no more punitive tax treatment of competing currencies like gold and silver, then let the people decide. Nobody, look, if Paul Krugman and Ben Bernanke want to trade in, who knows, if they want to trade in IMF special drawing rights, if they want to save their money in IMF fiat drawing rights, they're free to do. Why shouldn't they be free to do so? Let them make their. Now, nobody may want to take that currency in 20 years when they retire, and they want to use it to buy retirement. But they're. You know, PhDs, these are Princeton professors. You know, they're the ones that have tried to order the economic affairs of our whole nation to our peril. So let them go ahead and decide to save in special drawing rights or any currency that they prefer. But let the rest of us have a choice as well.
It's a theme. They talk about confidence. Back to the Lehman catastrophe there, the CEO Fold complaining on CNBC about these devilish short sellers. It's the short sellers taking down my stock. It's the short sellers destroying my company. And of course, we find out a few weeks later, yeah, the short sellers took down your company because it was riddled with mountains of toxic debt. An apt parallel to what we're seeing with the United States. Sure, we've got the AAA rating, but just like in 2008, where it took months, if not years, before the rating agencies finally came clean on many of the companies and countries out there with this toxic debt on their balance sheets, we too, on the United States balance sheet, that has to be dealt with.
Well, you're right that it does have to be dealt with. And look, I understand why, you know, the dollar appears to be more desirable than some other currencies for brief interludes. I've likened it, Chris, in the past to you take your family, your friends, your company, your employees, whatever, to the park, and you're out playing softball, or you've spread the blankets and you're having a picnic, and the kids are romping and stomping and having a great time, and all of a sudden it clouds up and it starts to rain. So everybody grabs the picnic basket and they head out under the bohio or under the ramada, you know, to wait for the little rain cloud to blow past, and then they'll go enjoy themselves again. That's the dollar. That's fine. Okay, there's a crisis. You don't know who to trust. You know that, when you invest in the dollar, you say, you know, well, you know, they may print these things at will, but even if they have to print it, they'll pay our money back. Our treasury will be paid, even if it's depreciated dollars. But whatever, we do not want to invest in rubles or yuan or euros or, whatever the other currency may be in the crisis during the circumstance. And that's fine for a few minutes for some people for certain needs. But I will tell you, it is, for people that are interested in insurance against a currency crisis, for long-term capital preservation, and even in times like this, I believe the gold price where it is now, even just for the pure pleasure of profit, you wouldn't want to live under the Ramada at the park. You know, you wouldn't want to try to withstand a hurricane there. It might be fine for the afternoon sprinkles, but when the real storm blows in, or when you huddle in for the night or for difficult times, you know, the Ramada is no place to be. You want to be in a sound structure.
We hear constantly from technicians and many folks out there that, well, I'll have plenty of time to jump back on the bandwagon when gold gets above that resistance at 1500, silver over 26. These debacles and issues come like a thief in the night. If you knew your house was going to burn down next week, of course you bought insurance this week. But we don't know when the threat is going to occur. I mean, it can come like a lightning strike. And that's why everybody has to have some precious metals insurance. Now, this wasn't the case 50, 60, 70, 100 years ago. Why? Because the currency had some backing. And even after the 70s, when Nixon slammed the gold window down, there was an enormous amount of silver money in circulation, which I think buoyed the economy somewhat. It's something that I've never heard any academic discuss.
Well, it was even more than that. I mean, look, we had growth that was the envy of the world. We had 6% economic growth. We had 4%. Even in the 70s, I think we were managing 4% economic growth. We were the manufacturing hegemon of the world. China wasn't even really in the game. There was effectively no China. You know, Russia wasn't even really, considered one of the producing nations. That wasn't even in the game. We had billions of people around the world under the heel of the boot of the state in communist systems that weren't competing with us. We were strong. We were robust. We were powerful. And so even if gold had been eliminated, people believed, you know, the American dream, American productivity, and so on and so forth. Well, they squandered that pretty well. I mean, we could barely eke out 2% economic growth now with the growth of the state. I'll tell you, better than a chart that correlates the stepped up increases in the national debt ceiling and the price of gold, people ought to look at a chart. And this is the theme of my most recent book, Red and Blue and Broke All Over. People ought to look at a chart that correlates the growth of liberty, or the inversely, the growth of the state versus the prosperity of the people. And so you can clearly understand, when you familiarize yourself with these arguments, that as the American state has grown bigger, the American dream has been suffocated. And the And I will tell you, the story of the dollar is evident. The long-term outcome of this story of the dollar is evident in this brinksmanship that is going on in Washington now. The reason that these shutdowns grow more severe, the reasons the divides grow sharper, the reasons the political rancor grows, and it's not just rancor between the Republicans and Democrats internally. Within the Republican Party, there's nothing more hateful than between a couple of factions in the Republican Party and the way they diss one another in their collegial gentlemen's club. But all of this is evidence that the pie itself is shrinking, that there are increasing demands for the American military overseas empire, for the military industrial state, for the welfare state, for the warfare state. There are increased demands for the maturing baby boomers and their retirement needs, for promises the politicians have made for prescription drug care, for health care, Obamacare. The demands are increasing, but the pie itself is shrinking. And so characteristically, the debates become more rancorous, more heated, more voluble, and there is a lot more of this ahead in our future. But I think that people that look at the state of the dollar and the alternative of gold and silver to the state of the dollar can, better than looking at a chart, better than looking at a trend line, an overhead resistance or a support level or something, look at the visible signs and the behavior of the governing classes as they go at one another's throat. Their very political survival is at stake, and so it becomes very bitter indeed, because they've cultivated constituencies that are now utterly dependent on their promises, and there's not enough pie to go around for everybody.
No, you talk about lack of growth, and if we look at 1980 to 2000, in that 20-year period there, as I think is evidenced in the charts, particularly by the Dow and the equities markets, the phenomenal growth, we don't have to even look at the GDP figures. I mean, just take a look at stocks on average. It was an incredible period of growth, and so the correlation, I think, between debt levels came insignificant. But today, we don't have that luxury of excess growth, or even, I think, acceptable growth levels. So debt becomes a huge factor, taking us back at least to the 70s. And I think we're seeing signs that the everyday person recognizes this, that this is why silver is flying off the shelves. Silver Eagles, they cannot keep them in stock. U.S. Mint showed that we had sold more silver Eagles this time of the year than all of 2012. The Nomoyen, if you will, recognizes that this is a genuine threat to everyone's wealth, the loss of purchasing power here. Well, as we wrap up, any other topics?
No, you covered them all, except to say you talked about the growth of the economy, the American economy, and the stock market during the boom years. You look at a chart now, you have to ask yourself, how does an economy that barely musters 2% growth justify a stock market that's done 20%. Speaking of correlations, as we have done on your program, if you look at the overlay, at the correlation of the wave after wave of the climbing stock market to these heights, and overlay that with the round after round of quantitative easing, you see the correlation is very clear. They're the only wind beneath the wings of the stock market here has been money printing, a perilous situation indeed.
Exactly, and we're watching that balance sheet expand at an enormous pace. The last check, $3.3 trillion, roughly $1 trillion a year, and the Fed can't even pull the trigger on reducing it $5 or $10 billion a month. It's comical. Even if they did drop it by $5 or $10 billion a month, or even $100 billion, it would amount to about $100 billion a year. That's still roughly $900 billion a year added to the Fed's balance sheet. Please tell folks more about your bestsellers, as well as any contact information.
CharlesGoyette.com. My website has been down for a few years while I've concentrated on writing projects, but it'll be up in another week or two. And that's about all. Ron Paul's America on radio stations all over the country, twice daily radio commentary on current events and news. Make sure your favorite radio station knows that they can have Ron Paul's America, the twice daily commentary. All they have to do is contact the syndicator for that. Their favorite radio station knows how to do that. And that's it, Chris.
Now, we're going to put links up to everything you've mentioned there to encourage our listener base. I want to encourage everyone to bookmark those sites ASAP. So, as always, Charles Goyette, we want to thank you for your comments today.
Wonderful to speak with you again, Chris. Thank you.
pleasure to welcome back to the show the silver investor David Morgan, publisher of The Morgan Report and silver-investor.com. Welcome back, David Morgan.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Let's begin the discussion today, if we could, with the silver market. You know, during market reactions, investors tend to seek intrinsic value to give them an idea of where the price floor is likely to come into place. According to one source, the true price of silver production is in the neighborhood of $20 an ounce for 2013. That would put silver near fair value at these levels. What production cost would you put on silver?
The Morgan Report did a very detailed study on the true cost of production. Now, we looked at several miners, and these are primary silver producers, such as First Majestic, as an example. Again, we did several of them, and we found it was roughly in the 22 range. It varies mine to mine. In fact, within, like, First Majestic, they have more than one mine under their corporate umbrella, and, of course, it varies from mine to mine, but the overall price was in that range. So, yes. And I want to go further, Chris, if I might. There's a book out long ago called You Can't Lose Trading Commodities. And anyone that's ever traded commodities or attempted to would be very fascinated by that title. So I bought the book and read it. In fact, he's actually a client of one of the brokers I use. Nonetheless, the point being that he made a very, very interesting point. What he said was if you can buy any commodity under the true cost of production and be patient, you will make money. And I think his premise is correct. So if you could buy, let's say, 18, 19 in that range and have patience, I'm not saying do it leverage, I'm not saying do it on margin. I'm saying if you can buy any commodity under the cost of production and be patient, you're going to make money. So that's about where we are right now. And the longer we stay in this range, the greater propensity there is for mines to slow their production or even curtail it or even close it. We've seen a couple of our juniors, unfortunately, one that announced is going into full production, had great metrics. It was small, could grow. It fit a lot of our profile for speculation. And we got fairly excited, but not overly so. And it wasn't within about a month or so after that announcement, they decided basically to shut everything down. And, of course, that was a huge disappointment for everyone. But you can see their logic. It was basically, well, if we're just going to be very marginal here, we really haven't ramped up yet. Rather than ramp up, we're just going to cool our heels for a while.
Very good. Well, you know, I like that concept of buying, you know, underneath the intrinsic value or near the intrinsic value, because unlike stocks, which hinge so much upon cash flows, we really don't have cash flow from most precious metals investment. And so by buying particularly bullion near its production cost, you do sort of have that insurance policy of knowing that in order to replace these ounces, this is what you would expect to pay. Move on to the CFTC report, and they announced the end of an investigation into complaints on rigging in the silver market and the related manipulations. I wonder if you took a look at this announcement and if you have any comments on silver market manipulation.
Well, certainly I have, and I did write about it in this month's Morgan Report. But basically, if you read the exact quote, what they really said was they did not say that they didn't find manipulation. What they said was that they didn't have enough information slash evidence, and those are my words, not them, but what they said was based on the fact-finding expedition that they've done for 5 long years, they haven't got enough information to go further and take anyone to task, be it an employee or a firm. So that doesn't mean that they didn't find evidence of manipulation. What it means is that they, at law, think that there isn't enough evidence, if you, and that's my word, to go further down the road. And I've always stated to prove manipulation is extremely difficult. However, is it done? Absolutely. Furthermore, I'm on record, and this is something I said in front of Bill Murphy and Jeff Christian, kind of opposite ends of the spectrum, if you will, at the Silver Summit probably about 4 years ago. And we were all asked about the silver market manipulation. And I said, the long-term trend cannot be manipulated. And I believe that's factually proven by the fact that both gold and silver have been in major uptrends for several years in a row, and not to make light of the fact that they've been consolidating in a downtrend the last couple. But the overall trend is up. But within the overall trend, certainly the market can be manipulated and has been and probably will continue to be so. But I don't like using manipulation as an excuse or someone that uses the idea that, oh, I can't win because of market antics. Because if you're really truthful and you really look at all markets, they're basically all manipulated. I mean, this high-frequency trading, the Exchange Stabilization Fund, the Working Group on Financial Markets, what goes on in options expiration, what the big brokers are allowed to get away with, the advantages that are given to the shorts, the advantages that are given to the commercial interests, and on it goes. Anyone that has any modicum of common sense can see clearly that these markets are not really free trading most of the time, if not for all practical purposes, never. That does not mean that you can't buy a commodity under the price of production.
No, exactly right. I mean, go back to gold market manipulation. Over, 100 years ago, you saw Fisk and Gould run up the price of gold, and then Gould pulled out his position on Wall Street, and hundreds of traders lost everything, and they simply blamed it all on Gould. But in the final analysis, you know, trying to point the finger at one source for manipulating a market, I think, is a lofty goal. Livermore, as I said, Gould, Fisk, Vanderbilt, many have had the finger pointed at them, but they were mostly scapegoats. Want to move on here to the Commitment of Traders Report. COT continues to improve here amid this reaction we've seen in the past 3 or 4 weeks. Commercial shorts clearly covering their positions. Any comments?
First of all, if you go back to the early days, meaning of this bull market, which would be the early 2000s for gold or silver, before the advent of the ETFs, this is prior to the gold ETF and the silver ETF, you could basically trade basis to the Commitment of Traders report with extreme accuracy. In fact, I did a special report that I put out at the Silver Summit years and years and years ago that showed exactly what to look for and how to do it. Since the advent of the gold ETF, the silver ETF, and several more besides the SLV and the GLD, it's been diluted. However, the COTs are important. So two further comments. Number one, the setup for the commercial interests have not been this favorable for about two decades. So we're talking 20 years now. So what that implies is that the overhead resistance in the futures markets, or in the derivatives markets, if you prefer, is probably better favorable to gold and silver than it's been COT-wise in a long time. But I was thinking about that today, Chris, and I started thinking that perhaps, and this is just an opinion, not a fact, that maybe they lightened up their short positions at the end of the CFTC investigation so they could just throw up their hands, had it gone further, which it isn't, and say, oh, well, hey, we're not always that short. Look at our recent activity. We're basically very lightly short, or some nonsense like that. Again, opinion. The second point being that, again, I think patience is something that you need to bear in mind here. Very few people are adept at trading. Most people that try it lose. But if you are looking for an edge, the COT is one that is a tool of many that can be used. Again, just to reiterate slightly, in the day, back in the early 2000s, the COT was a major tool to be used for timing purposes. Today, it's somewhat useful, but not nearly as much as it once was.
Folks need to, I think, turn off the computer screens every now and then and recognize that the long-term monthly trend, as you alluded to earlier, remains up, and we can't let ourselves get caught up in the emotion. It's typical after the parabolic rise we saw from around, I want to say, 2010 into 2013, and we had a threefold increase in the price of silver. That momentum has to be unwound. And if you're a long-term investor, who doesn't mind a lower price on your investment du jour? I look at these pullbacks as an opportunity as opposed to this end of bull market mentality.
I couldn't agree more. And its problem, I think, is that people get excited and they follow the herd and they get in this momentum thinking, or this idea that all they have to do is buy everything now. And that's really an undisciplined approach. And usually you pay a price for that. So people that got in, I was just doing another interview this morning, and this guy said, you know, he said, get in at 35. What I did say, and you can go back and check the records in the public domain, was that if you were going to buy, this is when it went from 19 to 48. When it went to 35, I was getting very nervous. But what I said publicly is, if you have to buy silver now, don't buy it all. And what I was explaining or trying to inject into people's consciousness was that 35 is pretty far from 19, where we were just, you know, a couple of months before, and it's going to pull back sooner or later. And I called the top at 48 almost within the day. I was about 2 or 3 days early. The point being that you've got to have discipline, and you've got to have a long-term view. You've got to know why you own these metals. If you own these metals for a quick buck and you have a day trader or trader mentality only, and I have both an investor and a trader mentality, then so be it. I'm not going to tell anyone how to run their lives. But if you own the metals for the right reasons, and they're down now, certainly you may be feeling some pain. But if they're fully paid for, no leverage, just wait. They're coming up.
Why don't you make a case then, if you don't mind, for higher precious metals, particularly silver? I mean, if we look at the fundamentals, of course, we're near the cost of production. We both agree on that. You know, it's not as though the Federal Reserve isn't printing any more money, and they did just curtail their end of taper discussion, so that was a bit of a shock. What do you think is going to be the impetus that brings the everyday trader back to the silver market?
It'll probably be after the fact. And what I mean by that, it'll be some kind of partial default. It could be something as easy as some big entity such as, let's say, Central Fund of Canada, or maybe the Zurich Continental Bank, or one of these larger entities that buys, you know, 20 million ounces of silver in one tranche, and all of a sudden that's delayed. Not officially default, of course, but there's a big delay. That could be one impetus. The other one is the fundamental fact that no fiat currency goes forever. The idea that the Keynesian model, which is if there's a delay on the economy, what you do is you stimulate the economy by injecting more cash through the government base. And that's been done in QE1, QE2, QE3, Operation Twist, the taper, the non-taper. And what's happened? Nothing. Nothing has happened except the banks have been made solvent. So clearly, everything reaches a limit. And the limit has been reached in the Keynesian model. It doesn't work. It's not working. And the Fed knows this, but they don't have anything else because that's the model that they base the whole economy on. So knowing that fact, if you don't own precious metals at any level, then you're actually missing a fundamental, very common sense concept. That is that all paper money throughout all of recorded history has had huge problems, and eventually they fail. Now, that doesn't mean it goes to absolute zero. That doesn't mean that you can't take a bunch of them and buy something with it. What it does mean is that Russia and China start trading with each other outside the dollar, that India and Russia do the same thing. These nation states are circumventing the dollar as much as possible and not buying our debt like they were several years ago. The dollar game is ending, and anyone that doesn't see that clearly is in trouble. And the way you protect yourself financially is to get into something outside of that matrix, and that means getting into gold and silver.
I think it's even more systemic than just the greenback. All major currencies, including the euro, the yen, the yuan, the pound sterling, and the U.S. dollar, throw them all into the mix. It is really a race to the bottom, as folks refer to it, as one currency continues to devalue in terms of all the others. This is a global phenomenon.
No, it's a world. The thing that worried me the most when I started the website and on the internet was that it is a global phenomenon. It's not just dollar-based. The dollar is a reserve currency, so as the dollar goes, so goes the global empire, you might say.
No, exactly. So, you know, then you have to find a place to harbor or crystallize the wealth that you've accumulated. But I wanted to also address the concerns that some of my guests have had on the show, including Peru Saxena, the technical breakdown that we're seeing in the charts in the precious metals. You know, under resistance around the $26 silver and $1,500 gold area, folks are concerned that we must get back above those levels, get back up above resistance before one should even think about the end of the downtrend.
Yeah, I'll be consistent. I pretty much said that myself. I mean, I really think, and it's getting tighter and tighter time-wise, that we will see the $26 level and the $15.50 level or so in gold. in the not before the end of the year. I don't expect them to trade at those levels and stay there. I think they'll be tested. But I think that was the breakdown level. Those were great support for a long, long, long time. And then going back to manipulation, we had this massive sell-off. I mean, who would sell two-thirds of the silver production on paper in a matter of 20 seconds? I mean, give me a break. If that isn't manipulation, I don't know what is. But proving it, well, that's a different story. Back on point, yeah, I think if you're very conservative and you're not sure that, you know, I'm right or whoever holds the opinion that the precious metals bull market is still intact, the way to become conservative is pay higher. Wait for silver to trade above 26 for several weeks and gold to trade above 50 for several weeks. Once that's established, then you have more certainty that the bull market is intact.
Very good. All right. I'd also like to talk about this dual threat of rehypothecation and bail-ins. It just seems almost every week we read another major story of legislation or account-related information that essentially says, well, you could be on the hook as an individual investor or as a pensioner or as a citizen for the mistakes made by these financial firms, banks, the industry, and even the government itself. Under those conditions, you know, one would certainly wonder about paper promises with regard to silver and be more inclined to procure silver bullion.
I agree. I mean, basically, the idea that a bank deposit is not at risk is ridiculous. In fact, what's interesting is I wrote about that in the Morgan Report about 1 month before the bail-in in Greece. And what I pointed out is if you read the contract, when you open a bank account, sign what's called the signature card, that's really contrast. And it's referred to as a signature card, but it's really more than that. What it basically says is these assets for you are liabilities on our side. And basically, it's their money once you put it in their bank. I know people have a hard time with that concept because they trust banks and, you know, it's in the bank and all these references we have to, you know, the bank soundness and that type of thing. But the truth of the matter is that they can do what they do legally. And there's been further legislation, if you will, across the board, Canada, U.S., other countries, that basically reinforce the fact that if they so choose, meaning the banking system so choose, they can go ahead and take whatever they feel is required to for their purposes. So, yeah, I think everyone in today's world that's aware of what's really going on, which almost reads like a science fiction novel, you've got to have some asset that's outside of the system. And that, in most cases, means gold and silver coins. What I'd like to do is suggest everyone goes to silver-investor.com and get on our free email list. When you're on a free list, we allow you to get a full subscription to the Morgan Report for a 30-day free trial. So you can see everything that's in the members-only section. And I don't have time to go through everything that's in there. It's a monthly report, but it's much, much more than that. Just the study on silver's true price and gold's true price is probably worth any serious investor's time. Not to mention all the special reports we have. For example, if you're going to trade in these markets, making the best advantage of your broker. And we David Smith that works with us has a special report called Harvesting Green on the Pinks. And we don't do a lot on the junior side, believe me, but we do some. And this report alone will save you money on how to execute an order if you're going to do a pink sheet stock. Even if you're not in the mining sector and you do any pink sheet stocks, that report alone is probably going to pay you back the cost of the report because it's going to teach you how to execute an order and actually do it to your advantage rather than the broker's advantage. But I could go on. I won't. We put a lot of our heart and soul into this report, and we have since we established the website.
David Morgan, we want to thank you for your time today, and we certainly appreciate your thoughts and perspective on the markets, and I'm looking forward to having you back on the show as we make an assault on that resistance and overcome the 26th level on silver. I think that's going to be an exciting time and bring in a lot more interest to the market as people hopefully recognize that the reaction is over and the uptrend is going to re-exert some influence here. So we wish you the best.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. With all the pressuring and posturing about the government shutdown and debt ceiling talks, a situation appraisal is warranted. This is the 12th government shutdown since 1981. The longest was under Bill Clinton in a sparring match between him and Newt Gingrich in 1996. It lasted 21 days. But most have been short, a few days or a week at most. Did any of this political theater have any real lasting impact? Was spending really curtailed and long-term changes really put into effect? Nope, not even close. Will this 12th episode of the government shutdown playhouse have any real lasting effects? Quite possibly. We've never been in this kind of global situation before, where virtually every major country is engaged in their own form of money printing, as in quantitative easing. We've never been in a situation where global and domestic debt levels are so insanely high. Rest assured, the debt ceiling will eventually get raised, as it always does, but not without both sides extorting some additional spending out of each other at our expense. Remember, the debts are never paid. They are only expanded at the cost of diminishing the future value of the currency. Something else that could diminish is confidence. I mentioned this last week, and I'll mention it again. Our entire financial system is built not on anything tangible like gold or silver. Our entire financial system is built on confidence. Confidence, those little slips of paper, will always be able to be exchanged for something of value. Or confidence that only a reasonable amount of those little slips of paper will be needed to trade for the things we need to survive, like food, energy, and shelter. What happens when suddenly no one wants those little green slips of paper? How do we buy a loaf of bread and a gallon of milk? What happens if people suddenly want too many of those little green slips of paper, as in double, triple, quadruple, or more, to buy that gallon of milk and loaf of bread? What happens then? The past government shutdowns have had very little long-lasting effects. This one is likely to turn out the same way. But now, more than ever, the risks and uncertainties are greater. The pond is smaller, and the rocks are bigger. And instead of ripples, the rocks are creating tidal waves. We cannot really do anything to change what's happening in Washington. All we can do is respond to the changes that are thrust upon us. We can align and redirect the forces of change so we navigate a different path, away from the psychopaths and parasites that would have us follow them over the cliff. The healthcare exchanges opened a few days ago. If you want to really know what your elected officials think of the average person who has to deal with this nightmare, just spell the phone number assigned to the healthcare hotline. It's 1-800-318-2596. If you spell 318-2596, you'll get a nice little reminder as you try to make sense of this growing nightmare. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.
right, it's time to open up the listener mailbag where I tackle email questions and comments. First up, Kevin says, Chris, I just listened to your interview with Peru Saxena, and I think I agree with you on this one. My cycles work in gold and silver indicates a bottom in October of this year, so I believe we're probably in line for one last downturn. I have also noticed a lot of the gold bulls recently have gone bearish, and this could be a classic sign of a bottom approaching. We are in the equivalent of the gold bull stage of 1971, when the dollar was removed from the gold standard. We shall see a peak probably in 2020. Well, hello, Kevin. Think it is interesting from a contrarian perspective, many of the gold bulls turning somewhat bearish, and I do think your cycles work sounds interesting. In my book, Wealth Building Strategies, I point out that trends are simply long cycles in much higher time frames, so from a fractal perspective, a trend is a cycle. Now, at the risk of coming off as maybe overly pedantic here, here is a colloquial example. Assume that silver is in a downtrend on the daily chart, but in the weekly and monthly charts, the trend is solidly bullish. So you could argue that the bullish trend we see is an up cycle in the long term, punctuated by the occasional down cycles in lower time frames. The fundamental factors supporting higher precious metals prices are also profound, I think, including dollar weakness. The dollar has had every chance possible over the past 3 years to rally, yet it is still range-bound, basically in the same position as it was over 3 years ago. Now, the near-term picture is very weak, with a possible head and shoulders breakdown forming. Demand for the metals is red-hot around the world. Investors are scrambling for metals at discounted prices. They know intuitively that real money is on sale. Now, what they may not know is why the real money is on sale, and that, I think, is the handiwork of the central bankers who are artificially holding the metals low with paper derivatives. So millions of global inhabitants are taking advantage of cheap prices, knowing that it can't last forever. And this is not rocket science, it's just basic arithmetic. Look at John Q. Public. Punches the time clock every day. At the end of the month, has a few dollars left over to pay the mortgage, gasoline bills, heating, and related bills and groceries. The portions on everyday items at the store and grocery are decreasing. The prices are staying relatively the same or inching higher. That's an interesting phenomenon. Reducing the portion size, holding prices steady, prices move higher. Half of America is living from paycheck to paycheck, lulled to sleep with a six-pack pizza and their favorite sitcom. Then, like a thief in the night, the grid goes down. There's nothing in the pantry, no solar panels, no bags of junk silver coins, no access to ATMs, no more gasoline in the gas stations, generators run dry. What will most folks do? Could we really be 3 days away from anarchy? Well, due to just-in-time delivery systems and poorly informed people, my guess is we may just be, and that will also be a big subject in today's segment here, but I do digress, so more on the grid failure and preparations in a moment. Now, in summary, I expect a retest of the summer lows in gold and silver, and if 1170 gold and 1830 silver holds, I expect to see on a weekly and particularly a monthly closing basis, then an assault on resistance. As listeners know by now, gold resistance is around $15.25 and silver resistance $26. Once those hurdles are cleared, expect every technical trader in the world to re-enter the bullish camp. The shorts will run for cover, but it will be too late. They never dug foxholes. If support fails, which I view as the least likely scenario, but one we must be prepared for, then a retest of 1,000 gold and $10 silver could be possible. But, you know, this is not a prediction, just decision tree analysis. I'm currently a buyer of silver under $20 an ounce and heavily interested at any level below that. As for the grid down situation, now please keep in mind this is just speculation, but I think the word on the internet and survival chat rooms is to prepare for a long-term grid failure event in a widespread scale. Most people think they can rely on their gas or propane powered generators. I have two 2000 watt generators, but I doubt that there will be any gas left over to keep them running for long. If you do wish to store gas, I recommend PRIG, PRI-G. It's the best gas stabilizer there is. In fact, some folks have claimed they found cars in the woods sitting idly for years abandoned, and they added PRIG to the gas tanks and used every gallon without any trouble. It's twice as
expensive as the leading brand, but I think well worth it. Still, even with a few gallons of properly stabilized fuel, the generators can only run a few days to weeks max. What happens if a solar storm or EMP blast crushes the grid? What about civil strife or a terrorist attack? I continue to promote a solar backup system as the best line of defense. Keep in mind, though, that an EMP or a solar flare could burn out the diodes in your solar panels. And the junction box on the back of solar panels typically have 2 to 3 diodes. You might want to keep a backup soldering iron. I have 2 soldering irons, one as a backup unused, as well as backup diodes to replace in the event of an EMP strike or, as I said, a solar flare. Now, currently, the tax benefits of solar panels are huge. The federal and state tax breaks can cover more than half of the upfront costs. The peace of mind, I think, of having a battery bank of deep cycle AGM sealed, no leak, no maintenance golf cart batteries wired in parallel for 12 volts, I think, is ideal. A simple MPPT 30 amp charge controller can now be purchased for as little as $50 on eBay. And these used to cost anywhere from $200 to $1,000. It maximizes your solar production and protects your batteries. 10 100-watt solar panels can be stacked against a wall in your garage, pre-wired and carried out in just a few moments. Put in a sunny location, and Bob's your uncle. You have 1,000 kilowatts of maximum production. Actually, more if you have a very sunny spot and solid wiring. Then, when trouble passes, you can simply carry 2 at a time back into the house and stack them neatly against the wall, taking up less room than a few plastic totes. In a true Teowaki situation, or that's the end of the world as we know it, you don't want noisy generators alerting the neighborhood that you are the one rich guy on the block who prepared, do you? I mean, solar panels are quiet, they can be easily hidden. I've seen preppers discuss how they will barbecue all of their meals. Really? How far will the smoke and aroma of your filet mignon carry? 2, maybe 3 neighborhoods? Hope you don't receive a friendly knock at the door late at night, or something worse. You know, solar power with a simple inverter can run everything from a convection oven to a simple and cheap electric stovetop or microwave. Plus, a small battery bank can run your television, TV, radio, laptop. We just purchased a $33 handheld rechargeable ham radio, and it's the closest thing to a cell phone when the system goes down, but there's no monthly fees, and it is rechargeable, so you plug it right into your battery bank, communicate with people around the town, around the county, around the state. $33 for a ham radio station? I mean, these are the types of things that battle cruisers used to have in World War II that would have cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, then tens of thousands, and then recently down to a few hundred, but now $33? Every family, I think, should have one, and if you have friends and family, you can buy one for each household. If it sounds extreme, talk to someone who lives in rural Alaska. Virtually every household is required to have a similar handheld device when someone gets in trouble. They don't have cell service. They can't afford telephone services most of the time, but they all have handheld radios. Neighbors barter, sell, and donate and keep in touch this way. The most cogent point, I think, for owning solar power is that it provides peace of mind for you, your family, no matter what. Let me give you an example here. What will you do when the generators run out of fuel? Of course, you can just run down to the gas station, right? Well, maybe. What if there are lines wrapping around the station and halfway across town? We saw this occur in the mountains near Asheville during the Katrina episode. You know, 1,000 miles away from the impact zone. Then even if there is gas available, well, I'll bet it'll be cheap. When Teowaki is extreme, folks will be irate. They could begin attacking vehicles, even taking pot shots with weapons. Roadblocks could be common. Maybe not a Mad Max Road Warrior scenario, but still something to think about. I mean, why is it so impossible to think that roving gangs are impossible? Look at that Mexican village in the news right now. Similar outcomes occurring in the modern world. Where are the authorities? Well, they might be hunkered down using their sick leave, protecting their home and families. Now, while these are clearly extreme circumstances, how could it hurt to be prepared? I suggest no matter how well times seem to be for everyone right now, by stockpiling canned goods and water, building a solar backup system doesn't have to be profound. It could just be a starter system. You can do a Harbor Freight starter system for less than $200. Buy a deep cycle battery from Walmart if you like. All right, thanks, Kevin, for that. All right, next, Daniel writes, other than aquaponics, which I know you favor, what would be the primary protein sources you would use to raise cultivate for a farm which could feed 10 people? Well, hi, Daniel. You know, there are so many factors to consider with this question. I mean, what is the growing zone that you plan to use? In other words, is it warm or freezing in the winter? How many acres do you have to cultivate? Do you have greenhouses or do you plan to build a greenhouse? What is the health of your workers? Is the land fertile or rocky? Is it hilly or covered with trees or stumps? You know, after over 4 decades of gardening, and you know, my family can attest to this, it's one of my earliest childhood memories, I found nothing that compares with the humble spud. That's right. The potato grows virtually in any soil or light condition. It can be planted early in the season and mid-season again for a double crop. You can simply pull it out of the ground, wash it, pop it in the microwave for a quick meal. Now let's compare that with wheat for a moment. I love these preppers who buy huge bags of wheat berries and talk about how they will grow it and live off the bread and cereal. Right. Have you ever grown wheat? Well, I have, and it requires very fertile soil, endless sunlight, perfect water conditions. Otherwise, all you have is a pretty lawn. Next, you have to cut down the wheat berries and separate them from the husk with a sickle. Do you have a wheat grinder? No, they're not very cheap, not electric ones anyway. I have a manual grinder and an electric grinder I use to grind my family's corn. But for most folks, this would be impossibly difficult. I mean, you need arms the size of Arnold to grind any serious grain by hand. My point is, if you make a mistake with potatoes, well, you have some potatoes. They can store easily in the crawl space of your home. No refrigeration or processing is required. No, frankly, fertilizer is required. And here's the best part. Next season, if times are really bad, you can use the shriveled up inedible spuds left over from the previous fall. They make excellent seed potatoes for your new season. Yes, I do have some Irish folks in my family, but few people know that the potato kept most of medieval Europe alive for hundreds of years. So I challenge you to find a vegetable that grows in such abundance that can give one that satiated feeling with so little preparation. Take a whole collard plant, for instance. Saute it in butter or oil. Can you really live off of that day after day? I suggest that few people can, maybe only cattle or goats. Now, speaking of livestock, many people ask about raising cows, chickens, etc. However, what we've found is commercial feed, even the organic feed, is filled with heavy metals that eventually cause illness in not only the animals, but those who consume even the eggs. All commercial feed that we've tested meets this criteria. So here are my favorite survival plants in order of importance. The potato, obviously. Peanuts are interesting. Beans are phenomenally easy to grow in huge abundance. And lentils, their cousin. If you are not producing produce with a high quantity of protein, I would suggest it's just not practical for survival. All right, thanks for that, Daniel. I hope it helps a bit, and I know a bit long-winded. Next up, it's Rick from Calgary. He says he loves the show. In a recent discussion with Dr. Stephen Lieb, there was a place that we can go to search for alternative energy information. He's interested in looking into this, where he can go to see on the website. And by the way, he says, P.S., this is what I am looking at right now. Well, hi, Rick. You know, I'd direct you to YouTube as a great starter place to learn about solar energy. Most folks begin with Harbor Freight, the 3 panel kits, less than $200 with a solar charge controller to charge up your batteries. I'd recommend starting there since it comes with a charger and 2 small 12-volt lights. Now, folks can get a feel at a very low cost through Amazon.com or eBay as well. My personal preference is for Renogy solar panels and the wiring. I like the quick snap-on and simple disconnect and the safety aspects of Renogy. They're also very reliable, and in my personal testing, it received more than 100 watts off of solar panels in extremely good conditions. We are talking at least 20 to 25 years of usage. What a wonderful thing. You're gardening photons. Think of it as harvesting the sun. So for more advanced novices, I'd recommend the Renogy starter kit with anywhere from 1, 2, or even 4 100-watt solar panels. And it also comes with the charger and sometimes with an inverter. I personally prefer nothing larger than 100 watts. Why? Well, because 100-watt panels are relatively lightweight. They're easy to move and to store and put on the roof. Anything larger is very unwieldy, quite heavy, requires surprising agility and dexterity to install. It's hard on the lower back, and there are some other dangers. I don't like anything less than 100 watts because, well, it's difficult to scale up to any meaningful current. Just remember to ground all solar panels with a grounding lug and at least 6 to 8 gauge bare copper wire. It's not cheap, pretty good price on eBay, with an 8-foot copper earth ground with grounding clip. Now, this tends to meet the code in most areas. I'd also recommend DC circuit breakers from Midnight Solar for both the positive and negative wires. I know electricians will write me and say, well, the positive wire has the most potential and it's all that's necessary, but I feel more confident knowing that any wire, even the grounded negative entering the premises, is protected via DC circuit breaker. This allows for more careful maintenance and shutdown of the entire system and complete blockage of amperage. I also prefer the external shutoff switch for firefighters to quickly turn off any external system. And I also like Midnight Solar's lightning arrestor for your DC and AC circuit boxes. Be sure to have a 250-watt DC breaker between your inverters and your battery and charger. Of course, I recommended the MPPT chargers for around $50 on eBay. Please keep in mind, none of this should be viewed as advice, just my personal opinion. It is, I think, an interesting hobby. But of course, if you're not a licensed electrician, I'd suggest having one help you set up your system. It just turns out that a family friend in my early days happened to be a licensed electrician. So you might say I had an inadvertent education at an early age. All right, thanks for that question. And next at bat, it's Darren from England. He says he's been a listener of the show since it started, and he really likes it. He says these questions are crucial, and he's positive they must be burning in other people's minds about the current economic climate. What will happen to the price of gold and silver when the derivatives bubble bursts? Will it just be the producers that survive, or will financial companies like banks and brokerage houses and clearing agents in the world go bust? Will everyone lose their jobs? If this is the case, will physical certificates and be worth buying? Well, hello, Darren. You know, there's considerable debate, I think, among the gold crowd regarding the derivatives question. Some will argue that the 1.2 quadrillion in notional derivatives, keep in mind now, that's 1,200 stacks of $1 trillion. Or you might say it's 1,000,000,000,000,000. That's right, 1,000,000 stacks of $1 billion. A little over, 1,000,000.2. Folks are saying that the 1.2 quadrillion in notional derivatives and nearly half a quadrillion with interest rate exposure could blow such a hole in the global economic system that massive deflation is inevitable and a global economic depression to follow. However, I propose that the parallel is a weak one at best. Firstly, we need to remember that the Federal Reserve was in place nearly two decades ahead of the Great Depression. Dr. Bernanke's study in this area of the depression may be based on some false assumptions. The Fed and the central banks are mostly responsible for all of the major bubbles since 1913 and nearly all inflation. So the most likely scenario would be similar to 2008, where the wheels fall off the economic semi and the whole system runs off the precipice. The reaction from central bankers, I think, is somewhat predictable. They print like mad to prevent economic collapse. At first, the metals likely suffer somewhat, but as it becomes clear that all fiat money is suddenly worthless, the dash for tangible gold and silver begins as 7 billion inhabitants realize that they have been living in a collective fata morgana and the illusion is over. Nothing intangible has much of any value, and only tangible items are worth their salt. If this seems implausible, let me digress for a moment. I think we should base our conclusions not just on axioms, but more on empirical observations. Simply put, as a research scientist, a burgeoning economist, and statistician, I give considerable weight to conclusions based on actual, tangible observations and less on the conclusions, axioms, and definitions of others. I simply mean to say that all fiat currency systems have and always will fail. It's just as simple as tossing a ball in the air. We know that eventually gravity will overwhelm the force that led it skyward and it will tumble back to the earth. In similar fashion, someday, likely sooner than later, given the number of bail-ins and fiascos, gold and silver will again be viewed as real money. You know, here's an example. 5 years before the Weimar hyperinflation, a 1 ounce gold mark was worth, well, 1 mark. So you could purchase 1 mark of items with an ounce of gold around 1917, 1918. At the end of the hyperinflation, just 5 years later, That same coin, and I am not exaggerating here, had a purchasing power of 1 trillion marks. Now, I think there's several ways to illustrate the importance of this remarkable understanding. You could say that anyone who still had an ounce of gold could purchase a small city and was suddenly wealthy beyond the dreams of avarice. Or you could say that a wealthy man with 1 billion marks at the time in the bank, intangible goods, was suddenly worth 10 times less than a homeless man who found a golden mark. The walkaway point is that eventually only those with gold and silver bullion and coins, and perhaps legal title to gold mines through certificates, will have much of any wealth. All right, I want to thank you for your questions and comments. We certainly like to hear from all our listeners. If you'd like to call in your questions and comments, you can do so at any time. We have a toll-free hotline for you. It's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can call in any time you like, and we'd like for you to jot this number down, please, on a post-it pad and keep it close to your phone or plug it right into your cell phone or telephone. 1-800-507-6531. That's the Gold Seek Radio toll-free hotline for questions and comments. 1-800-507-6531. Whatever's been keeping you up at night? Well, maybe you'd like to have a sound night's rest. Forget insomnia. You can put those worries behind you and put it on the air. 1-800-507-6531. There's more GoldSeek.com radio coming your way after these messages. Richard Doughty, the Magambo, publishes the Magambo Guru economic newsletter online, and it's a pleasure to have his many decades of experience here. Welcome back, Richard Doughty.
Well, thank you, Chris. It's wonderful to be back.
Well, you know, the top story in the past week or so affecting the market seems to be that FOMC yawn decision. You know, they just agreed to maintain their $85 billion buying spree of toxic debt, and apparently they're not as convinced about this nascent recovery they keep talking about. There's some dissension in the ranks, you might say, at the Fed. What do you think?
They cannot stop. It's just not possible for them to stop. They must keep going forever and ever and ever. That's a problem with a fiat currency built on such absurd fractional reserve banking requirements. Once you get started, so much money is owed versus how much money there is that if they stop creating it, that people can't pay their debts anymore. They can't even pay the interest anymore. So they have to keep going. There will never be a stop to this.
What exactly is the exit plan here?
There is no exit plan. That's the rub of the whole thing. There is no exit plan. You know, I spent an entire month going through Keynes's book on unemployment, interest rates, and whatever it is. I forget the name of it now. But there's no way to get out of it. They never mention it one time. Talks about incurring the debt to provoke the animal spirits in people and get people back to work and all that heroic stuff, but there's never one word about paying it back, and the reason is you can't pay it back. The whole Keynesian argument was on stimulus spending was that it has a multiplier effect. You pay a man a dollar to dig a hole. The man who digs the hole takes a dollar and buys a dollar's worth of meat. The guy from the meat store buys a dollar's worth of bread. The bread guy buys a dollar's worth of clothes. And so there's $5 worth of spending where only one was spent. The problem is it also works in reverse. If you don't spend a dollar with the hole digger, he doesn't spend a dollar with the butcher. The butcher doesn't spend a dollar with the baker, and the baker doesn't spend a dollar with the tailor. And so that's the problem with the whole thing. It goes in multiplier in reverse, and that's why you cannot stop creating more and more money once you get started down this path.
At the risk of getting too esoteric, could also discuss the fact that there's considerable literature indicating that maybe none of this debt can truly ever be paid off at all. You know, if you look at the way the fractional reserve system is set up, every time one person puts, let's say, $1,000 on deposit at a local bank, an additional $9,000 is created out of thin air. And this has a multiplier effect because those dollars can then be deposited at the same bank through other clients or additional banks. You might argue that the system is virtually doomed from its inception.
Well, you know, it is. And the way that it worked out in the past is all the money has been put into non-economic investments and malinvestments of one sort or another, and they're just wasting resources. And so a recession comes along, these stupid investments go bad, everything goes to bust. Freeing up all those resources to be used by other guys who are smarter and going to use them better, and the society rises from the ashes. But there has to be a big wipe out of all the people that invested their money so that the money can be wisely invested by somebody else. But the Federal Reserve won't let that happen. We never have Schumpeter's creative destruction. It just keeps on this bloated economic system they developed. They're trying to keep it going at all possible costs. And that cost is trillions of dollars a year in new money. Chris, I mean, every economist from Keynes himself admitted it. Keynes himself admitted that the stimulus spending would cause inflation in prices. But it was his idea that unemployment was worse than inflation, and Hayek, on the other hand, decided inflation was worse than unemployment. But we know who won the argument. Keynes won the argument. So everybody agrees that all this money is going to create inflation in prices.
The argument is, well, you know, 2 to 3% inflation per year, it doesn't hurt. Looks great on paper. That's in the virtual world. Over long periods of time, let's say 20, 30, 40 years, or even a generation or two, it really takes a bite out of savings. It takes a bite out of investment. It takes a bite out of virtually every aspect of society, not galloping or hyperinflation. What it seems to do is pull out the underpinning underneath the working and the middle classes and cause a very slow erosion likened to a sinkhole. So the house seems like it's on very sturdy foundation. And then, you know, as a resident of Florida, I know you're familiar with limestone erosion and sinkholes. And then suddenly you wake up and your neighbor's house is 20 feet underground.
I've always had a problem with anybody that says that a little inflation is good, particularly that Janet Yellen. That's one of our big selling points, is she thinks a little inflation is good for everybody. Well, let me tell you, if you got a bond you paid $1,000 for and it lost 2% a year, if interest rates go up by 2%, inflation goes up by 2%, so interest rates will probably go up by 2%, you lost 2% of your bond and you lost another 2% of the other $980 you had left. You tell me how that guy losing money is good for anybody. I just reject that completely out of hand.
It's great for the politicians, though, you see, because...
For the banks who loan the money, because now they can buy that loan back and get a discount, yeah.
And it's good for the government, because all of those huge entitlement programs, suddenly the payouts are significantly lower. 2% on, let's say, $1 billion is some pretty good walking around change.
Yes, as far as the government goes, I don't see where a guy declaring a loss on his tax return and reducing his tax remittances is good for the government. The guy lost money, he's in a bad way, now he's giving less money to the government, and the government needs the money. I mean, how that's going to be good for anybody.
But you know, maybe we digress here. James Bullard said, he's one of the Federal Reserve Bank chairmen there at St. Louis, he says to expect a small taper, perhaps as soon as the next FOMC meeting in October. He said that the decision was a close decision. This ongoing improvement in the Labor Department could lead to some tightening by the Fed. Are you buying this rhetoric?
No, and I am angry that someone would lie to my face directly like that. The American economy is not going to recover. Employment is not going to go up. Interest rates are not going to go down. And the government's going to create more and more inflation, and which is going to drive interest rates up, which drives bond prices down, which means there's lots and lots of losses out there everywhere. The 10-year bond bottomed at about 1.5%. It's now almost 3%. Everybody owning a 10-year government bond is now showing about a 40% loss on paper. And these are trillions of dollars worth of bonds, and it reflects trillions of dollars worth of derivatives and trillions of dollars worth of other bonds and trillions of dollars worth of other things. Money is being lost now. There are people sitting on paper losses. They just haven't declared them yet. And they're hoping the Federal Reserve will create enough money to buy up so many bonds it drives interest rates back down, making them whole. But there are gigantic losses on sitting on books everywhere. Anybody that owns a bond, a 10-year bond, is showing a loss from 3 months ago, a big loss.
I'd also like to discuss the significance of a growing theme we're seeing throughout the global economy, bail-ins. I know people are becoming more cognizant of this threat to almost every aspect of savings and checking accounts. We've seen several forms of this. We've seen it take the form of rehypothecation, which is just one of those esoteric terms to describe when your brokerage firm essentially borrows your margin account and makes some shady deals, and suddenly no more margin account, and they say, didn't you read the fine print, i.e. MF Global. Essentially, that just means that they made a little boo-boo, and you're on the line. The governments have picked up the ball here and said, hey, this is a new, neat little trick. They first tried it in Cyprus, and they just did it again in Poland, which is kind of frightening. They said, hey, you know, we're going to say half of pension funds drop a zero there. We're going to knock off about 50% because, well, the government's gotten itself in trouble, and after all, you are the government. You're the people, right? So we're going to borrow your pension funds, and many other nations, including Iceland, Canada, New Zealand are also changing the verbiage there, and we're starting to see it even pop up here in the United States. I'd like your comments.
Well, bail-ins, it's one of those last-ditch desperation moves. If your bank goes under because they've taken all your money and frittered it away, your money's gone. The only hope you have is that they take your money and save the bank. So if your money is the bank, your money's gone already. It's been loaned out and gambled away, and they're sitting on all these losses. And so instead of just telling everybody, hey, your money's gone because we gambled it away, no, we're going to bail in the bank, and that'll be everybody will be happy then. So yeah, it's a last-ditch desperation move. How willing are people going to be able to spend when their money's gone? Half my money's gone? Do you think I'm going to go out and buy a new car?
Well, you know, I think that leads me to the point here. Under such conditions where we're seeing this growing trend where, you know, there's the MF Global, Cyprus, and now setting the stage for numerous new bailouts the next time a sudden financial crisis circa 2008 comes along, and we know we can't be too far away, there's very little available to shield the investor from these obligations that are tied to their brokerage accounts, bank accounts. Anything in excess of the insured amount is now suddenly on the chopping block almost worldwide. That should be enough, I'd think, to put the fear of God into people.
But in America, we can print our own money, where in the EU, they really can't. They all have to go to the European Central Bank, and then they'll be squabbling among themselves. Well, why is Italy getting all this free money? Then why is Greece getting it? And the French want to know why the, you know, it goes on and on. So you can't do that very well over here. But over here in America, the Federal Reserve nearly pushes a button, gives the banks all the money they need. Don't you worry about a bail-in over here. That's a long way off.
Read recently that Italy, its largest bank, is now doing its own form of bail-in on its customers. Not to mention, we're now hearing that the Dutch bank, Amro, refused to deliver its gold bullion that it had promised its customers. If you look at it in the big picture, it's funneling, or it's almost a vortex leading to a singularity, which I can't help but think, of course I'm biased, makes a great case for precious metals. I'd like your thoughts.
Well, you know, I think what makes a better case for precious metals is the last 2,500 years of economic history of the world. This is nothing new here. Every government, there's been thousands and thousands of governments that have spent themselves into bankruptcy and tried everything they could to get their, dig their way out, which included stealing everything from their citizens and stealing everything from a neighboring country by declaring war on them. This is nothing new. And what is the one constant in all that time? People that had silver and gold did very well. Everybody else did not. How can you argue with that? 100% of the time in the history.
Magambo, they didn't have iPods. They didn't have computers. We're smarter than them, right?
Oh, I so wish that was true. You know, hey, wait a minute. If that's true, you know, I never thought about these ramifications. Thank you, Chris. It's a whole new line of...
All right. Well, as we wrap up here today, are there any other topics that I've missed? I'm sure there's a couple of things that you're watching closely on your radar screen.
No, I'm just watching the whole thing basically collapse because so much money is being lost and governments are being paranoid about it. And the people who lost the money, they're being paranoid about it, and they're doing everything they can in a desperation move to save their jobs. So that basically comes around to this money sloshing around. There's not enough money sloshing around, and now the Federal Reserve is going to make sure they have lots of money sloshing around. And even if that's not going to be enough. Inflation is running about 8-9%. If you look at John Williams' shadow stats, who figures inflation the old-fashioned pre-Clinton way, inflation is a lot higher than that. Bonds are so grossly overpriced, they've got to collapse by at least half just to get back to within being reasonable, halfway being reasonable. And then when bonds go down, the stocks go with them. I mean, then how? Who's going to buy a house when their stocks and their bonds have gone down? And their 401ks? That's what the 401ks and IRAs and people's retirement accounts are full of: stocks and bonds. And people are writing derivatives on stocks and bonds. It's a gigantic. Oh,
you've covered a lot of great bases there, and we recreate a similar metric to Shadow Stats inflation number, and you are right. A lot of folks think that it's the food and energy that makes the big difference, but in my calculations, food and energy is a rather small incremental aspect of the inflation differential. It really comes down more to housing prices. People don't realize that has given the artificial illusion of lower inflation because home prices have come back so far, but now that's starting to taper off as well. And I also want to address your housing idea that folks will stop buying houses. I mean, this is a very salient point. As interest rates start to rise, those mortgages become very expensive. And I wonder how many people have really thought this through. If interest rates continue to climb, you know, just what will happen to the housing sector, which seems to be currently making up one of the strongest and most essential parts of the U.S. gross domestic product.
You know, the funny thing about houses, I'm not sure what's causing it. My personal belief is that a lot of that money overseas is coming over here and buying up U.S. property at relatively cheap prices. And so it's Americans. I don't know if it's all that many Americans are buying.
What's going on is we're seeing hedge funds that focus entirely on buying up distressed properties and foreclosed properties, those with great potential. Think of it as a vacuum cleaner. They've been sucking up all of those low-priced houses since 2009, packaging them, then most likely selling them as mortgage-backed securities once again. What that does is it prices out all the little people out here who wanted to buy a house at 2008-2009 prices. Now have to pay, thanks to the fact that they were packaged and mortgaged and securitized on Wall Street, we have to pay an extra 20, 30, 40, 50% that we shouldn't have to pay because they're artificially propped up. Richard Daughtry, we want to thank you today, and I want everyone to direct their browser to the Magambo Guru Report. Do you have any contact information for them?
Just the MagamboGuru.com, run by Junior Magambo Ranger Doug.
We'll hopefully have you back soon.
It's always wonderful talking to you, Chris.
Murphy is at the helm of the Gold Antitrust Action Committee, GATA, with Chris Powell working on behalf of investors to expose the powers that be manipulating the precious metals market. Welcome back, Bill Murphy.
Great to be here, Chris. Thank you.
You know, I understand you have some big news regarding the ongoing silver investigation.
The CFTC, after 5 years investigating Morgan for manipulating the silver market, decided to drop it today, saying that there was no basis for them to go further. It took them 5 years to do this, which is beyond me, but it's so egregious because right now the Justice Department, and this is according to Morgan themselves, is investigating Morgan for market manipulation and wrongdoing in six different aspects of their business. And I think there's been one or two added since they announced that. It's unbelievable how they're being investigated by the Justice Department. So, and the CFTC investigation in the silver was probably the most obvious one of all. I mean, GATA testified, thanks to Andy McGuire, in front of the CFTC over 3 years ago with emails about their investigating it. There was two more whistleblowers that surfaced last year that talked about J.P. Morgan's trading in offshore accounts, manipulating the market. One guy got so afraid he moved to China. I mean, they have it all. But as Goddard said, we're not surprised in the slightest and expected this because, as we have long claimed, the manipulation of the gold and silver markets is partly a government operation. The CFTC is investigating their own bosses. The fact that they wouldn't come up with anything is par for the course.
Do you suppose that silver might be a victim of its own diminutive size relative to other markets? I mean, for instance, the entire silver market can't be as large as just one single Dow component.
Well, that's a good point, and that's obviously the case. And the reason they're manipulating the silver market would say who would care because it's looked as money like gold is. And way back when they decided to get into this price suppression drills and scheme, they realized they had to manipulate silver as well as gold because the dichotomy of one doing one thing, one doing the other, wouldn't work. So they got involved heavily into manipulating the silver market for that reason.
It makes you wonder what they're thinking, though, because even the Rothschilds, who were known as the world's experts of the precious metals markets, they got out of the business, you know, about a decade ago.
Well, that was a good point, because they're very smart people, and what they did was get out of the fixing business, which they were a part of for hundreds of years in London, and they knew all about the price manipulation. They knew it would eventually fail. They knew the price of gold and silver were going to take off because I think when they got out, the gold was something like $460 or something. It went up to nearly $2,000. So they knew what was coming, and they think big picture, longer term. They know it's going to be a big scandal someday, so they just said they washed their hands of it and walked away.
They were heavily involved in the market back to the times of Napoleon. I mean, they were cornering the British bond market and selling precious metals, I believe. As Waterloo was announced, their couriers gave them the information something like 12 hours ahead. In a Bloomberg.com survey, 64 economists expected the Fed to taper. Fed officials, they obviously know something the rest of us suspect. What do you think?
They don't like to jerk a lot of their people around, so to speak, in terms of setting things up. And they had to be petrified to tinker with this tapering situation. They left it alone and stunned everybody. And what it says is just really how what they've done hasn't worked to what they need to do yet. The economy in the U.S. is on shaky ground. Even today, Walmart started making noise about disappointing sales, and there's a lot of things turning. And this is after pumping all this money into the system, although a lot of it, as we know, has not gotten in the system. So it just shows you how really difficult situation they're in, and it explains why over the past year the gold has been killed while the Dow keeps going up on the same tapering situation. So they're petrified of something. They're petrified of higher rates. They're petrified of what the dollar could do. They're scared of some kind of black swan derivative event. And that's why they've been all over the gold market.
Shift gears to the silver market. You know, demand remains incredibly strong despite lower prices. We're seeing record demand from retail and high net worth buyers. They've consumed 15% of the total world silver production. That's 120 million ounces of the 787 million total mined from 2012. The U.S. Mint reported record sales of silver coins. That's 33 million, over 1,000 tons already. That matches last year's total sales. The Perth Mint, the Royal Canadian Mint, near record sales again. And plus, sources show 144% leap in the maple leaf sales, 60% surge in the sale of silver maple leaf coins. What do you think? Is demand as hot as folks think?
Yeah, well, the big guys are out there for sure. I'm not so sure what the little guys are doing because from a lot of sources I get, you know, they've backed off. Now, of course, demand from overseas is very strong. And, of course, it should be for what these prices are. They're artificially low. With gold, anything above 1,300 or down here, and you know, silver where it is, at, you know, $21, $22 an ounce. I mean, it is retrospect to be seen as an incredible buy. So it's certainly a great time to be accumulating.
According to the COT report, commercials are once again covering their shorts as we start to see them cutting back on their bearishness. The markets tend to find their footing, particularly in silver here. Do you have any comments on the COT report?
Well, the big one is that the open interest in silver has gone down from 166,000 contracts before the mid-April, what I call a financial terrorist attack, down to about 112,000. And meanwhile, as would be expected, J.P. Morgan, well, of course, there's no fixing, has been covering its short positions on the way down. So it's setting up for washing out the market for a very substantial move to the upside, and it should occur this fall, or I'll be off base.
Well, I know you also keep an eye on the technical side of the markets, and the picture has been improving in the past 2 months. After this sluggishness passes, do you agree we're likely to see a retest of $15.25 gold and $26 silver?
Yeah, well, if I'm correct again, you know, they've pretty much washed this thing out to do what we mentioned earlier, why they took it down, and these prices are just way too low. And at some point in here, they're going to have to retreat again, and which is what they did, you know, after 2001, all the way up till, 2 years ago. And then, of course, it was just going to be a year ago soon when they started to bring gold out from 1793, you know, back to below 1200. So it's been quite a raid. We think they've gone through a great deal of their available central bank supply to do it. Everybody knows the Chinese are just buying the gold up. I mean, it's phenomenal what they're doing, and that increases every year, and it's a new demand item. So they've had to give up a lot of their gold to do it, and I think they're going to be forced to retreat again, and we should have a spectacular fall.
You know, it's a great point, because India is apparently going to pull back on some of their more stringent import laws against gold, because they were trying to repair their balance of payment with the very, very sluggish rupee, trying to support their currency there. And they couldn't curtail oil because it's the lifeblood of the economy, so they targeted gold. Interestingly, silver did skyrocket in demand in place of gold during that time. So they're pulling back on some of their import levies, if you will. So that's going to be, hopefully, an impetus for higher prices in gold. And then, as you say, China, you know, the amazing singularity drawing in huge amounts of gold, and once it crosses that event horizon, it's never seen from or heard again. It's illegal to export any sizable gold bullion from their shores. And we're hearing of record imports from Hong Kong into mainland China. Plus, they can hardly keep supplies of silver and gold on the new Shanghai Precious Metals Exchange. Unlike the COMEX, which it's like pulling teeth to get any gold off the COMEX, the Shanghai Exchange actually specializes in delivery. If you can imagine such a thing, it's an index, that an exchange that does its job. And they are delivering huge amounts of gold and silver. So it's certainly something to watch.
I think it's interesting that, you know, as you mentioned, the getting into the tapering thing, I reported as way before it happened, minutes now, that this thing was obviously the gold price jumped. And it was obviously people had inside information. There's been a big flap lately about this millisecond algorithm trade right at the time. But no, it's much bigger than that. Friday before the Lawrence Summers announced, all of a sudden, late in the day, gold moved. So it's just part of the corrupt nature of the gold market. I mean, it's just unbelievable. So what happened was, you had the tapering, gold goes up $70. And just like you mentioned, the Fed beat people who predicted what was going to happen. Everyone was caught offside in the trading world, except for those people who were able to get out of it right ahead of the announcement. And so that we're going into an option expiry today, and so all of a sudden these people were all exposed. And of course, for the tape, the gold should have kept on going. Instead, they put in yet another raid. Gold was taken right back down to a low of 1305 yesterday. Allowed all these people to get out. They were caught offside, bailed them out. And now that it's ending, people had a chance to get out again this morning with a 1316 low. And then all of a sudden, now gold's up to 1335, 1338. Going right back up again. They let these guys out.
We were talking about this before the show, so just to give people the context. One of the largest moves in 2 years occurred right after the Fed announced no tapering in precious metals, particularly gold, ran up nearly 5% just after that move. And you pointed out, and they knocked it right down, and it just smacks of more manipulation.
We have never seen the gold cartel be as aggressive as they have been. We pointed out every day, Plan A, they sell around 3 a.m. New York time. They have the same kind of, they do the same maneuvers over and over and over again. And we still think they're going to be forced to retreat, but it's all being managed. And until it blows up, it's probably going to be managed.
As we wrap up here, maybe you could tell folks more about Gata.org and La Metropole Cafe. I understand that Chris Powell will soon be making an interesting and exciting trip into Asia to spread the gospel.
Yeah, he'll be out there spreading the Gata gospel in Asia and Australia, New Zealand, and leaves on Sunday. And I think he's going to be on CNBC over there with Bernie Lowe, too, and that should be a great trip for him and for Gatta. People go to www.gatta.org to check out what Chris is up to and what he sends out, and then they can go to La Metropole Cafe, which I've been doing for 15 years now, and they can sign up for a two-week free trial and see if what I have to say is of value.
Very good. Well, hat tip for all the great work you're doing, and please keep it up.
Will do. Thanks, Chris. Have a good one.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. The filibuster this week by Senator Ted Cruz met with mixed reviews. The filibuster is a mechanism that was created by our forefathers for stalling a vote and making a political point. It has been a useful tool throughout political history. It was created long before the age of social media, 24/7 news, and telephones. This week, in a vote to defund national health care, i.e. Obamacare, the filibuster became a caricature of itself, and the leadership that is supposedly running our country became an even larger caricature of themselves to the entire world. The issue that continues to be forgotten by U.S. citizens, their elected officials, and the media is that the whole world is watching the leadership fiasco in Washington. The risk is not whether Obamacare is defunded or not. They'll simply print the difference for any financial shortfalls. The real difference is much larger. That risk is an accelerated loss of confidence in U.S. leadership, which could translate into an overnight loss of confidence in the financial system. Analysis of what could become the potential trigger for the next economic crash often focuses on systemic cracks like debt, derivatives, unemployment, and inflation. But what if the next crash was triggered by the cumulative effects of what appears to the rest of the world as an unacceptable level of out-of-touch incompetence? Is that too harsh an analogy? I think not. For example, we're having a debate about defunding national health care, a bill that was passed and signed 3.5 years ago. A bill containing over 2,500 pages that no one read in its entirety, and very few fully understand yet today. A bill of unprecedented cost and enforcement. A bill that purports to solve one set of ailments by creating a whole new financial disease. The rest of the world has problems too, many of which are far worse than those in the U.S. But at some point, are one too many countries around the world going to look at the U.S. all at the same time and say, "Are you nuts?" I'm talking about countries that hold much of our debt in the form of dollars. I'm talking about a loss of confidence that could easily be triggered by staged political theater. The snake that bites you isn't the one you see. It's the one you don't see. The lone snowflake that causes the avalanche flutters through the air on a beautiful sunny day. Too many people only notice things after they've happened, instead of anticipating or observing things while they are happening. The financial system isn't backed by gold or silver anymore. It is only backed by confidence. applied leadership is the only thing that can help maintain that confidence. And right now, that kind of leadership is in very short supply. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.